Check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, Andy Barra is Development and Communications Coordinator at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Going to be here talking about the Wisconsin voter suppression bill and the injunction and their part in all of this, and really the suppression bills across the country as Pennsylvania works to get its way into the, well, not-so-sweet 16 of states that have gone after voters, especially working people and the poor. This idea that, well, you know, you need to show your driver's license or your voter card to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Even they say it doesn't exist. But imagine if you're homeless. Imagine if you're struggling to make ends meet. Imagine if you're my grandmother who hasn't driven a car in 10 or 12 or I think it's 12 years now. Explain to me how it is that you're going to go about this, especially if, you know, if you've been going, like in the community where my grandmother lives, they have a van that the city sets up that'll take you to the polls. It'll come around and it'll come take you to the polls. If you're one of the seniors on the list, because, you know, where my grandmother lives in Brooklyn, Ohio, one of the really good places for seniors to live because of all the services that they used to have. I mean, a lot of them are being gutted now because, well, they've got a cut, gut, and punish Republican over there. And no big surprise there. Gotta save corporate taxes. Gotta be more business friendly. And to be honest, not really his fault, because we've allowed these businesses now to hold us hostage. But we're gonna talk to Andy Barras about this voter suppression thing, especially with folks who are homeless. In the second hour, Mike Lanfum is gonna be here, coordinator, for the United for Fair Economy's Responsible Wealth Project. He's gonna talk about the book that he co-authored titled The Self-Made Myth. And the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. I'm going to talk about this whole thing that, you know, we keep hearing, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And, you know, with the Forbes 400 coming out today, I loved going through them and seeing all the people who are self-made. And they got their money from government largesse. Just amazing. But hey, it doesn't fit in the frame. The frame is they're all Horatio Alger figures, and they whittled bootstraps out of wood trees, and they weaved it together with hemp, and they pulled themselves up. Also in the second hour, executive director of the AFL-CIO, Arlene Baker, going to be here talking about the International Women's Day and the war on women that's going on across the United States. It'll be interesting to talk to the executive vice president there at the AFL-CIO. And in the third hour, Lee Fong is going to be here from United Republic to talk about the Koch brothers wanting to take over the Cato Institute, which I thought they already were in control of, because I thought it used to be the Charles Koch Institute or something at one point before they turned it into Cato. But Cato's kind of gone, well, we're going to stick to our strict libertarian ideals. And the Koch's going, no. That libertarian stuff, to a degree, we buy it. But when you start talking about stuff we don't agree with, we're going to take it back. So we'll talk to Lee about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Great to hear from you. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So from the grave, the righties are bringing up Breitbart and saying, oh, his one last shot at Obama. See, he has this video of Obama hugging somebody. And they're calling it Huggate or some nonsense. And here's the thing. As president of the Law Review, he gave a speech. And he gave a very good speech. I mean, the only thing I guess you could prove from the video as I sat and watched it was he was a really good public speaker. He was very good at drawing in the crowd, very good at playing to the folks. You could see right then that he was going to be something special as an orator. And did a fantastic job, but the righties, man, they want to go after him. See, he was, this community organizer who was riling up stuff. And the reality is it doesn't prove that at all. It proves the guy gave a good speech. And the person that he was supposed to hug, this radical, this Dr. Derek Bell, what was he fighting for? Well, he was fighting to get more diversity on the faculty at Harvard. Something at that point, there had been three African-Americans on the faculty, and one woman. And I guess she was a white woman. And all the rest were very lily white men. And he said, look, I'm going to take a year. I'm not going to take a salary. I'm stepping aside until they bring their practices around. And you got to give him credit. He's standing up for his beliefs, said, look, I can't afford to take a year off, but I firmly believe in this. And as you looked through the crowd of people, I keep getting this right-wing frame of they're radicals, and these are just radical people who and they want to destroy the country, and they're mostly very rich white kids. Because you don't get to go to Harvard if you're not in that upper echelon, unless you're really, really smart. And you can get some kind of a scholarship. But the majority of those kids in that audience were very white kids. And I think that's what the radical right fears, that there are going to be smart white people who, smarter than they are, who are going to go, we need diversity. That's what makes us a better nation. That idea of the melting pot, that we're all in this together. Well, that doesn't fit the right-wing frame. The right-wing frame is, we need the 1%. We need the people to create jobs. We need the job creators, those 1%. We need those rich people. And they're saying, on the other hand, what they were saying is, no, we need this together. And you look at the reality, as inequality has continued, as we've allowed division to continue, what's happened? Well, the wealth class has grown, they've grown wealthier, and the rest of us have not. And I look at that video, and I go, here was a guy, he was standing up for, at the time, the 99% saying, look, these handful of rich white guys who get to decide who's on these, on the faculty, these handful of people like the Kochs, like the billionaire class of the era, they decide who's on this. By the money that they donate. I mean, what we've learned over the last couple of years about the Koch brothers, especially, I pointed the example of Florida State University, but you could go to any number of colleges where they've donated to the endowment. Well, we want something for that, though. And like at Florida State, for $2.5 million that the one year, they were able to say who was and who was not going to be on their business faculty. And you go back to that speech that Obama gave saying, look, this guy's a good guy, he's somebody that we all look up to, kind of at the time standing up for the 99%, the rest of us. And I look at this study that was done by two political scientists, a guy named Keith Poole and Howard Rosenthal. And they tracked how much the proportion of wealth that's gone to the top 1% and the extreme ideologies that have propped up. And what they've done is they've come up with this idea that there's this phenomenon going on, that as the 1% continues to grow more and get wealthier and wealthier, the partisanship gets more polarized. So the more money they have, the more polarization that's gone on. And it's a really interesting graphs as you see the Forbes 400, if you will, grow wealthier and wealthier, that Republicans go further and further to the extreme. Now, they've gone and they've said, you know, look, Democrats, there's really very negligible difference in the ideology. And I've been saying that for the longest time. Democrats have actually moved to the right, not to the polar left. They've continued to move slightly over, while the Republicans have taken this rightward dart, this 90-degree turn right to the extreme, right off the, in my opinion, off the cliff, because this billionaire class has said, here's the money. We're going to continue to push you in this direction. And you stop and look at some of the facts that are out there. We are now more unequal as a society than countries like Iran, Uganda, the Ivory Coast, even ancient Rome. And you just look at the numbers. I mean, the numbers are right in front of you. From 1978 to 2007, that top 1%, that investor class, they have seen their wealth grow by 275%. You and me, somewhere around 18 to 40%. So what they've done is they've been able to buy politicians. And you get someone like Santorum who says, I'm all in favor of income inequality, yes. And you got Romney out there saying, well, you know, those people who talk about the facts, those people who say that my class is taking 275% of the pie, well, they're just bitter. And they're practicing the politics of envy. And I say, no, these are people who see what's going on and say, I don't think so. But in their study, they point out that, you know, you give these people like Sheldon Adelson all this money, what's he going to do? He's going to cause mischief. He's going to pursue his radical ideas. Not necessarily the ideas of the rest of us. Not necessarily you and me, but them, the handfuls. And you see that as the billionaires have lined up between their puppet, behind their puppet candidates. And what's happened is they've grown and grown and grown. And today's the big day that Forbes came out with their global numbers. In 1987, there were only 147 billionaires in the world. And they controlled about $295 billion at the time. Now you fast forward to 2012, we've got 1,226 billionaires, about $4.6 trillion. And you stop and think about, well, where'd that wealth come from? Well, back then you had a tax system that, you know, kind of said, hey, you're going to need to start paying something. Now we've been handing out money to the billionaire class for, well, at least 30 years. And I would even argue that, and I've seen statistics that you go back to 1982, where there were 3 billionaires in the country, and thanks to the Reagan handouts, cutting that top marginal rate from 50 down to 28%, created that 1987 scenario where you had 140 across the globe, but 41 here in the U.S. In 82, I've read that there were 3. So now here in the U.S., we've got 425. Hooray for us. We're number one. Yes. And of course, we've got some of our favorites. You know, the one from here in Pennsylvania, Richard Mellon-Scaife. Who's worth, $1.3 billion. Got his money the old-fashioned way. Yep. He was born. That's the old-fashioned way. His great-uncle, Andrew Mellon, said, here's all my money. And what's amazing is, after that evil estate tax, after that evil money was taken away and hijacked from the Mellon family, Scaife is still, well, rich. He's still a billionaire. So I guess it didn't really put them into poverty, did it? As the radical right keeps telling us. Oh, the estate tax will destroy families. Well, it didn't do much to Rockefeller, because we still know that name. And understand, John D. Rockefeller was the first guy to pay the estate tax. 70%. 70%. And we still hear the Rockefeller. I have yet to find a homeless descendant of the Rockefeller era. I have yet to find that guy. Maybe when we talk to Andy Barras in the next break, maybe there will be a Rockefeller in one of the homeless shelters that we don't know about. But then there is my favorite billionaire. Ah, yes. Everyone has to have their own favorite billionaire, and mine is number 330 here in the U.S., 913 globally. Yep. His name is Stephen Schatz Piscotty. He owns the Baltimore Ravens, made his money the old-fashioned way, sending jobs overseas. He's self-made, they tell us. So he sent all these jobs overseas, and he did it all by himself. So all you people who lost jobs because he shipped them overseas, you really had nothing to do with it. So there you go. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with Andy Beres from the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In Michigan, a labor coalition, including the United Auto Workers and the Michigan Education Association, has launched a campaign called Protect Our Jobs. The goal is to protect collective bargaining rights and also to preempt any effort to make Michigan a so-called right-to-work state. Right to work is a misleading name for laws that seek to destroy or weaken unions. The Protect Our Jobs campaign says Michigan workers helped to create the middle class, and now they must protect their collective bargaining rights to rebuild their economy. The unions hope to use this campaign to collect enough petition signatures for a Michigan constitutional amendment protecting collective bargaining rights. If enough signatures are collected, the measure could be on the November ballot in Michigan. As Wisconsin prepares to rally at the state capitol in Madison once again this weekend on the anniversary of the huge 2011 pro-labor protests, the nation continues to watch this historic uprising. OPEIU International President Michael Goodwin was in Madison last March. He says the Wisconsin uprising and the recall against Governor Scott Walker is having a big impact on the national labor movement.
It woke everyone up to the reality that this can happen in my state, too. So Wisconsin's fight is everybody's fight. And all the public employees around the country are looking, is my governor going to do this next? We've got to stop it right there at the water's edge, so to speak, in Wisconsin, so that it doesn't spread to other states.
Goodwin says, despite some misgivings that Obama at times hasn't done enough for workers, labor is behind his reelection. Goodwin says Obama's recent UAW speech is one sign the president is willing to be stronger for workers.
We were a little disappointed last year because we thought he was a little sluggish. He really didn't come into Wisconsin as we expected him to. But then, you know, we had a meeting with him, labor leaders, in August, and we laid out what the situation was, and he has responded. We told him that he has to be more proactive toward labor. He has to state his position, not having behind some kind of veil or something. You know, come out and state it, and surely the UAW speech was really a blockbuster speech where there's no question that President Obama is the man for the unions to get behind.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We'll send you a message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy. Don't go to the polls.
Well, yeah, that's what they want. They want you to stay home. They want you to be disenfranchised. They want you to throw up your hands and say, there's nothing I can do. which is why I think it's important that people take to the streets. Like today, you've got folks marching from Selma to Montgomery, just as they had done 47 years ago this week. And our quote of the day comes from Lee Saunders, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFSCME, who rallied with the marchers, calling out politicians who claim their attempts to pass these disenfranchising voter laws is, well, we're going to somehow end voter fraud. He says, quote, "It's really about ending the right to vote, stealing that right from people who don't look like them and who don't share their philosophy that the poor should be faceless, voiceless, and powerless." He says, but we refuse to let them do that. And I, you know, look, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we're about to join the not-so-sweet 16, I guess, on Monday. They're going to be looking to pass this voter suppression bill, putting us into that not-so-sweet 16 category. And look, it has nothing to do with voter fraud, nothing at all, because even they can't tell you. They cannot point to a case. They cannot point to a conviction. They can paint to nothing. But, you know, I had one guy tell me, if it stops just one, it's well worth it. And I asked the question, well, what about the tens and hundreds of thousands that it could suppress? Amazing, amazing stuff. I've asked Andy Behrens to come and talk to us. He is Development and Communications Coordinator with the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. His group was part of the lawsuit in Wisconsin that got a temporary injunction. Andy, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm glad to be back, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this voter suppression nonsense, and, you know, Wisconsin, one of the first places it propped up, and I think Saunders is right. This is to take away the rights of people who don't look like them and who don't share their bizarre philosophy.
I mean, I would never presume to speak for what's in someone's heart, but the fact of the matter is it's really obvious what the consequences are going to be. No one can plead ignorance. There is ample evidence of who's going to be affected by this. And as you were just saying, there is absolutely no evidence that the type of fraud this is seeking to prevent even exists. I think nationwide in the last 10 years, we've only seen three cases of this type of fraud. So it's a solution to a problem that doesn't even exist.
And it's not even really a solution. What it's going to do is, you know, you look at budgets across the state, across the country. Here in Pennsylvania, we're cut-gutting and punishing students and poor people and disabled. We're stealing money from those programs, and yet this is going to cost us $11 million that we don't have. That's $11 million we could have spent on education.
Well, what's really ironic is when you think about the way that money is being appropriated for $5 million, think of the number of homeless people you could get off the street so that they aren't classified as homeless voters anyway. So yeah, in this era of, you know, attrition and deep budget cuts in both the state and, you know, at the federal level, this just doesn't make any sense. They are flushing $5 to $11 million down the drain with absolutely no purpose whatsoever.
Yeah, it's just nuts. And, you know, I look at, you know, this week, you know, we had considered going down to Selma, Alabama to partake in the events down there, the march from Selma to Montgomery, highlighting 47 years. And this is these attacks on minorities still going on. I mean, not much different, just a lot nicer now, I think. I think we're a little nicer to minorities and poor people. We do it with a smile while we're screwing them.
Well, I mean, there is a sense that, you know, that racial equality has, you know, come into balance and that we're sort of, you know, past all of that. But unfortunately, you know, what we're seeing is that the socioeconomic conditions haven't necessarily changed that much. I mean, among homeless people, about 70% are minorities, and that's reflected in the general poverty statistics as well. So this is a huge problem. That's one of the reasons why we recently, last Friday, amended our lawsuit to include a Voting Rights Act claim, because, you know, as we've been discussing, minorities are going to be hit the hardest by this, and, you know, they represent a number of different constituencies, like the homeless, the poor, the disabled, et cetera.
Yeah, I worry about all of those, and I worry about my grandmother. I mean, there was a story yesterday, on Tuesday, that, you know, in Ohio, you had an 86-year-old World War II vet who got his photo ID from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they would not allow him to vote.
It is absolutely outrageous that someone who has served our country with such distinction and has an ID given to him by the federal government would be prevented from voting. It's outrageous. And, you know, this isn't an isolated incident, Rick. Like you were saying, pointing to the number of pending proposals in 2012, this isn't a couple of legislatures going off the reservation. What we're seeing here is a pandemic.
Yeah, here's the thing. Here's my question. You're so worried about that one case that they may have found, or two cases that they may have found over the last 20 years. What about the people that they stole their right to vote? Why isn't that a crime?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in fact, the argument that we're making is that, in fact, this isn't lawful. So there's a couple concurrent lawsuits going on right now. We have one with the ACLU, and the NAACP has one. So the NAACP is challenging it on the Wisconsin Constitution. We're challenging it on the Voting Rights Act and with the U.S. Constitution. So the court ruled in the NAACP case, issued a temporary injunction that would basically, the law is still in place, but it would prevent it from being put into action in the upcoming primary on April 3rd. Unfortunately, that's not a done deal yet, because the state is going to appeal this prior to the primary. Our hope is that the injunction will stand, and that over the next several months, as our litigation goes to trial, we can finally put this to an end.
Yeah, I love the attacks that have been going on against the judge who issued the injunction, this Judge David Flanagan, who they're now saying, well, you know, he signed the recall petition, so he shouldn't be allowed to decide on this.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak with a lot of specificity to that, but I mean, people, you know, grasp at straws for any argument. The fact is that it would be difficult for any judge with any amount of experience or respect for the law to come to any other conclusion.
Now, let me ask you this. You know, I keep hearing people say, well, you know what, I've got a driver's license in my wallet, and, you know, it's not a big deal for me to pull out my license, so it's not difficult for anyone else. Everyone should have one. Everyone should do it. What do you say to people like that who say, you know what, I can do it. Why can't everyone?
I think people just don't understand all that's involved. I think there's a tendency to, for human beings to project, you know, their own life onto other people. But these people that are saying that, they, one, have easy access to, the type of ID they need. But also, if they did not have that ID, they would be able to produce a birth certificate. What we're seeing here is that if you're a homeless person living on the street, the odds of you retaining a copy of your birth certificate are very low. And then you have to pay to obtain it. So if you're a homeless person that's living hand to mouth, barely scraping by, a lot of times not eating at all, where are you supposed to get that $20 to obtain your Social Security card, to obtain the ID? This is an affront to something so elemental to our democracy that it's sort of outrageous that we even have to have the discussion.
Well, what do you say to those who say, well, you know, if they don't have an address, they shouldn't be able to vote anyway? Because I've run across people who've said, well, they're homeless. Where do they get to vote? They could vote in a whole bunch of different places.
Yeah, I mean, there's ways around that by, you know, listing a shelter as an address. But the bottom line is this. The Constitution guarantees everyone's right to vote. It doesn't guarantee the right to vote if you happen to be in a certain socioeconomic condition.
No, that's, you know, that's the way I see it. But, you know, you hear folks on the right, well, you know, and look, as a talk show host, as an American, I look at what we're doing around the world. You look at Iraq. If you remember during the Bush years, we were so proud as a nation that all of the Iraqis got to vote. And I remember them all holding their finger up with the ink on it. Yet we're doing everything we can do to undo what we've done over there.
Yeah, irony is rather palpable. And then you add to that the fact that, you know, our own electoral process is not reflecting what we're hoping for emerging democracies. But you add to that the fact that, you know, if there's a veteran who was over there helping, protect the emerging government as this election over there was going on, some of those same people could be coming back, becoming homeless because of PTSD or other things, and they could be denied the right to vote in America when they were protecting it in Afghanistan.
Now, look, you had a former congressman yesterday who was turned away from the polls down in Tennessee. I mean, what we're doing is just mindless, which is why I'm a big fan of same-day registration. And instead of making it harder for people to participate, what we're doing, we should be making it easier. But what we're doing, it seems, is just the opposite. And I think the clip we played in coming into this segment of Paul Rawick saying, you know, back in 1980, we want to hold the vote down. We want to suppress the vote because if that happens, we win.
Yeah, I, you know, as I said, I never want to try to look into someone's heart, but I do know the practical implications, and I know that there is just no legitimate measure by which this makes sense. And so for anyone in a legislature to pass a law like this while claiming to be fiscally responsible is just not borne out by the facts.
Not at all. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you. You know, because here in Pennsylvania, they've said, well, you know, if you don't have a photo ID, well, we'll still give you a provisional ballot, and you can cast it. But if you come back in a week with your ID, then we'll count it.
Right, exactly. So, you know, unless a homeless person finds a bag of money with $10,000 in it, I don't know what a week's difference is really going to do. So, I mean, that's just sort of a red herring to put in there to look like they're being more reasonable in the implementation of the law, but it has no legitimate impact.
Yeah, but again, you know, it looks nice window dressing. Hey, we tried.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all presentational, but the bottom line is, in Wisconsin, as much as 12% of the population could be disenfranchised if this law goes forward. And Pennsylvania is an industrial state that's been hit hard by the economic and foreclosure crises as well, so the same dangers exist there.
No, I look at my grandmother, 82 years old, hasn't driven in probably 12 years, doesn't have a driver's license, doesn't have a photo ID, been going to the same place, you know, for years. Now, I guess out of luck.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's really what it comes down to in the end. I think this is the type of thing where, and I really appreciate that your show covers things like this. I feel like people would be more outraged if they actually had an understanding of the implications. Because, like you're saying, at first glance, it can seem pretty reasonable. But when you start peeling back the layers and realize everything that's involved and all the hoops that these people are going to have to jump through. I can't think of anyone who would support it.
Yeah, I'm hoping we still have a chance because they're not voting on it until Monday, from what I understand, which is why we need to be calling our representatives, telling them no on 934. Andy Beres, I appreciate the time. It's always great having you on the program. I appreciate it.
It's wonderful to be here, Rick. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Andy is the Development and Communications Coordinator over at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. We've got a link to their site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Andy's name. Quick break, right back after this with your thoughts.
The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Every day on the job, hundreds of miners descend deep into the earth. And every time they go down, each of them wonders, will I make it back to the top today? These days, though, miners and their families are wondering if federal prosecutors will make it to the top, wondering whether justice will catch up to the top honchos of Massey Energy, who are responsible for killing 29 mine workers in a horrific methane explosion deep inside the corporation's upper Big Branch mine 2 years ago. So far, no. But even the odious former CEO of Massey, Don Blankenship, must now be having some sleepless nights, for the Justice Department has steadily been climbing up the corporate ladder. Prosecutors have gone from indicting a couple of lower-level Massey managers to now nailing Gary May, who was superintendent of Upper Big Branch when it blew. The charges against May show a corporate-wide, careless culture of profit over safety and a deliberate policy of deceiving mine safety inspectors. May allegedly directed workers to falsify official safety record books, and he used codes to warn workers that inspectors had arrived, calling out, "Bringing in a load of blocks," and "There's a hailstorm outside." So warned, workers were expected to act quickly to hide such violations of safety laws as rigging the ventilation system to make the air in the mine seem better than it really was. May is also charged with such deadly practices as ordering the rewiring of a methane monitor to keep miners working even as levels of explosive methane rose dangerously. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Superintendent May is not likely to be the Justice Department's final rung on its climb up Massey's corporate ladder, for he appears to be cooperating with prosecutors. I think we'll find that the murderous conspiracy to subvert safety laws ran all the way to the top.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
It's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So you got to love Wisconsin. You know, had that massive uprising a year ago, 100,000 people in the streets, constant protests going on. Now this massive recall, all of the stuff that's been going on there, the courts putting the brakes on their voter suppression bill. So what do the Republicans do? Well, they blame the people for wanting to throw them out. And while they're doing that, the Wisconsin State Assembly voted Tuesday to amend their state constitution. You'll never guess what they wanted to amend. They want to be able to make it infinitely more difficult to recall governors, to throw people out of their jobs. The Republican supporting the bill and the person who sponsored it, this Robin Voss, have argued that the changes are needed to limit recalls given the flurry of such efforts over the past year. Because Republicans say that Walker and the other six that were recalled, they're just targeted for doing their job. You mean turning the state upside down on its head, forcing multiple employers out of the state because you're insane? You mean that's just doing your job? Maybe that's right wing doing your job. Maybe it is. I could be wrong. He said going to create 250,000 jobs. Last I heard, they were losing tens of thousands of jobs. So kind of going the opposite way. So, time to go. But, the Republicans, while they have the reins, while they're in control, they want to make sure that they maintain that control and just change the rules while they can. Got to love it. Anyway, the president was giving a speech at a Daimler truck factory in North Carolina. And, these Republicans have been going, the president wants the gas prices to go up. He wants $20 a gallon gas. And, to the president's defense, no incumbent president wants to see prices go up. Nobody. But at least he's being honest about it. And he said, look, we're not going to be able to drill our way out of this. Not going to be able to drill our way out of the problem of high gas prices. Anyone who tells you otherwise doesn't know what he's talking about, or they're not telling you the truth. And, they're lying to you. You know they're lying. Anybody surprised? Anybody be surprised? Raise your hand. Because that's what they do. And you look at the attacks that have gone on against alternative energy. You look at, they just want to take down the entire solar industry, all of the alternative energy. Went after Solyndra, which, if you went back and you looked at all of the tech companies that failed, where were they then? And you think about where we are today because we invested heavily in that. We could be 30 years down the road and be completely energy independent. Or we can be right back where we started from, worse off than we were before. And you look at the righties, you look at people like Limbaugh and fake news on Fox and all these T-twits going after anything, solar, wind, anything, the Chevy Volt. I did a Fox Business show a while back. With a guy from, I think it was from Cato, actually. And he said, well, you know, we all must drive volts. You know, he had to get his volt shot in there because it's on their talking points. So you see this week, General Motors told their employees in Detroit, some 1,300 of them, that they were going to be laid off temporarily for 5 weeks because demand has gone down. And, you know, the CEO, Dan Eckerson, GM CEO, said, look, we didn't design the Volt to become a political punching bag. And he said, but that's what it's become. And you look at the fact that, you know, the righties today, for today, it's a witch hunt is what it is, bottom line. They held a congressional hearing titled Volt Vehicle Fire. What did the NHTSA know, and when did they know it? Now understand, the NHSTA, they said, look, the fires caused in these cars are of no greater risk than gasoline-powered vehicles. There's no difference. But the righty's got to throw that out there. See, it's a hazard. Because they want people to walk away from them. And especially somebody like Lindball, who was at the front of all of this, going after attacking the Volt. And, you know, to me, I look at this, and what pops into my head is you've got these righties, you've got these conservatives, these cons, who are saying, well, we want these products, we want this industry to fail. Understand, this is what's going to save this nation, moving towards alternative energy. That's going to save this nation. That's going to keep us a world power, because everybody in the international community knows if you can make sure, if you can secure your energy needs, you're going to do well in this century. We have 2% of the oil reserves in this world. 2%. We consume more than 20%. Drill, baby, drill ain't going to work. The Keystone XL pipeline, we've already found out, it's going to actually raise prices. Now, as I've said before, and I think it's worth saying, if you build it to Chicago, I might be for it. Put that oil across the U.S., bring prices down, let's talk. But that's not what's going to happen. And the idea here is that the righties, they want to destroy alternative energy. Why? Because they're in the pockets of the big oil companies. And you look at this research done by Deutsche Bank and the Rockefeller Foundation. They found that if investments in energy efficiency, by retrofitting buildings and shopping malls and all kind of stuff, they're saying your investment will be brought back 3 times. If, as a nation, we were to invest something, and their number was $279 billion, to retrofit residential buildings, to retrofit commercial buildings, institutional buildings, we could save $1 trillion. Their numbers, not mine. And then you add to the fact that we could save 30% of our entire energy spending, much like I put solar panels on my house. Why? Because it's going to save me 40% of my energy needs. And it has been, it's cut my bill by 40%. But beyond that, beyond the financial savings, you think about we could reduce greenhouse gases by 10% as a nation. And, according to their research, create 3.3 million jobs. You want to talk about job creator? Right there. So when the president came out with this, you know, the Cash for Caulkers program, I'm a big fan. Let's go and let's retrofit buildings. Let's insulate. Let's do all of those things that saves energy. And you go back. I mean, there have been tons of studies on this. This is not new. It's not new that if you do smart things, you look for the future, you're going to be able to reap those benefits. But what's going on is the big money people, well, they don't want that. They want to make sure that, you know, we're addicted to oil, and they want to make sure that they can get in our pockets whenever they want. You know, we've got the technology in this country to say right now, from this point forward, every home built in this country, every house will be off the grid, will be energy independent. And that the homeowner will spend an extra $15,000 or $20,000 to buy the home. But you know what? They're never going to have to pay a dime for energy needs. Who would lose in that scenario? Well, PP&L, the big energy companies, they're the losers, which is why we're never going to see it. Which is kind of funny. I got this letter from my electric supplier, PP&L. They wanted me to be part of their big panel, their powerful panel of 1,000 customers in the state of Pennsylvania to give them feedback. So I go to the site and I say, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to sign up because I want to be able to have a say. So I have to go through a survey first. And the survey was, you know, basically what I thought of them. And I just put down all average. I probably should have said they were wonderful and they did everything outstanding and they were fantastic and terrific. But I didn't. I said, look, you know what? I think everything is right where it should be. It's right in the middle. Not allowed. They wouldn't let me in. So again, back to the big club idea. It's a big club. And evidently I'm not in that one either. So they're not going to let me into their little panel because it's all propaganda. They want people who are going to buy into their wonderful. And I don't buy it. I would tell the truth. And boy, the truth, I guess the truth doesn't set you free. Lastly, before we take a break, a lesson. And you got to love John Kasich at this point. In Ohio, they have the Utica shale basin. We've got Marcellus shale. They've got Utica shale, which is a little bit deeper. And what they're saying, what Kasich is saying, he's going to introduce a tax for the oil and natural gas producers before opening it up. And you gotta love this. You know, he says he's studied what's going on in Pennsylvania, all the debate over the fees and, you know, all this stuff, as well as the explosion in North Dakota and the failure of services. And what he said is, he said, you know, we learned from that. What we learned from that is to get it right from day one. And you know what? I've been saying that about this administration, well, since their day one. They've gotten it wrong every step of the way. And it's nice to see Kasich flaming Corbett. And I guess turnabout is fair play, because you may remember Corbett's memo flaming Kasich over workers' rights. I guess this is a shot in the ribs back. So good to see Republicans eating each other. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yes, I'm working all the time. It seems to me I could live my life a lot better than I think I am. I guess that's why they call me the gummy working man.
Making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, how getting a good night's sleep might help your memory.
A new study by Michigan State University researchers suggests that even when you're asleep, your brain is processing information. It suggests that your brain activity when you're asleep might influence your waking memory. The Journal of Experimental Psychology published this study in September of 2011.
The researchers call what's happening in your brain during sleep your sleep memory. They say it's a new, previously undefined way of thinking about memory, the way you consolidate memories during sleep about events that happen while you're awake. They don't know yet exactly how it works.
More than 250 people took part in the study. It showed that if your sleep memory works well, your overall memory for things like reading comprehension, learning vocabulary, decision-making, and problem-solving might work well too.
But, the researchers said, the ability seems to vary among individuals. That is, you and I could get the same amount of sleep, and your memory might benefit while mine wouldn't. This isn't the first study to suggest that sleeping benefits your brain. And that's the take-home message here. According to the National Sleep Foundation, 63% of Americans say they don't get enough sleep. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Yeah, you know, that's the absolute truth. And you look at Romney now, who Romney at one point, at least took a reasonable stance on minimum wage. Said, look, it should be indexed to the consumer price index, some index so that as inflation goes up, the minimum wage keeps going up to meet the needs so that we don't end up having the Reagan years. We don't end up having the Shrub years, and now the Obama years, where it just doesn't go up, but, you know, the cost of living keeps going up and up and up. And what you end up doing is devaluing the minimum wage to where it's no longer a wage that you can live on. It's a poverty wage. And understand that, you know, the righties get it, that if you start letting the minimum wage go up, that means everybody's wages go up. And there's going to be pressure on everywhere. Because if you're making the federal minimum wage right now, 7 and a quarter, the guy who's just maybe a step above you on the economic ladder is making probably $8 an hour. So if you raise the minimum wage up to $8 an hour, that guy's going to go, I'm not working for $8 an hour. I should be up a little higher. And it's pushing everybody up, which makes everybody a little bit better off. A little bit. Now, the righties will tell you, well, we just make the one minimum wage $100 an hour, which is, you know, just completely ridiculous, which are the kind of arguments that they would make. But you got Romney now, who at one point had a rational position. Now, I guess he's, again, not surprisingly, changed his mind, saying that there's not a need to raise the minimum wage. And you kind of just scratch your head and you go, again, another issue. And you could just tick him off where he's been. I think he wants to be all over. He must be a hugger. You know, like my producer, he's a hugger. He's a guy who comes up, just has to hug you. I'm really not. But Romney has to be, because I think any issue, he just wants to wrap his arms around and really give it a good embrace, a good hug. Because he just wants to be all around. He wants to be everything to everyone. Until the people who fund him, the people who are going to make sure that he gets the money he needs, says, well, no minimum wage. No, we can't do that. Especially the people in the upper echelon. And CNN had an interesting article, and Andy sent me an email with it, and he said this article, CNN Money, it was dated 3/5/12. And he quotes from it, income goes up, especially for the rich. The author, Tammy Luby, shows nothing has changed. The rich continue to crush the other classes in wealth disparity. In 2010, the top 1% captured 93% of the income gain for the first year of the recovery. In 2010, overall income rose by 5.2% over 2009. Salary and wages rose only 2.1%. The super rich saw theirs go up by 11.2%. So you go by bracket, who made the money? From 2009 to 2010, those making $250,000 and above, they saw their income rise by 13.8%. Those people in the 200 to 250 range, they saw it go up by 6.7%. People in the 50 to 100,000 range, where a good number of Americans are, 1.5%. 1.5%. Those in the lower end of the middle class, they saw their wages drop by 0.7%. So while the rich are getting richer, again, this is highlighting the fact that the rest of us, well, we're broke. The super rich experienced 37% increase in capital gains, while you and I, well, not so much. And you look at the reality, the tax system is horribly skewed to benefit those of wealth, while you and I, again, short end of the stick. And as they keep going, well, you know, we'll just keep raising state income taxes and fees and all of these other things. And this is why I was with the Tea Party. Right at the very beginning, before they took that rightward descent over the cliff, I was with them. Taxed enough already. I'm right there. Even if most T-Twits don't know what T stands for, I was with them. Because you look at all the things that they nickel and dime all the time, they're in our pockets. The wealth class, they don't have those problems. Put that down on those people, the rabble, the unwashed masses. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, stop and think about it. The 1 year, 93% of all of the economic gains of the nation went to the top 1%. 93%. And if you're in that top 1%, you made about $352,000 a year in 2010. That's what puts you in that top 1%. I mean, it's just amazing to me that we put up with it. And you got Tricky Ricky Santorum running around saying, well, you know, those high-income people, they don't have to pay taxes. So we shouldn't have taxes on them at all. We just continue to tax you poor people because you can't afford to go get a lawyer and fight for yourself. You can't afford to go do all those tax avoidance things. I mean, just stop and think about it. His argument is, look, well, they're rich people. They can do whatever they want. If they want to leave, they can leave. If they want to not invest their money, they won't. And I'm going, really, they're not going to invest their money to make more money because they're going to have to pay a little bit of tax on it? Really? Are you really going to make that argument? And the answer is, well, yeah, because that's what they do. They think we're stupid. You know, understand, when the tax rates were 92%, rich people still invested. When the corporate tax rates were 35% and 50%, businesses still existed, and they did really well. But we seem to keep buying the right-wing frame that somehow, you know, we need lower taxes, we need less regulation. And you look at the Business Roundtable, who has come out with a new plan. And I, you know, I didn't even need to read the article or the plan to tell you what it is. I did, but I didn't need to, because it is what it is. It's, we need to cut, and punish. We need to cut regulations, we need to cut spending, and we need to give them big tax breaks. That's their plan. And they had a meeting with the Blue Dog Coalition, more of my favorite Democrats. You know, the big CEOs from the Business Roundtable, they went and they sat down with the Blue Dog Coalition. They also had a sit down with President Obama and Timothy Geithner. And the plan, Taking Action for America, again, cutting spending. We need a balanced budget. We need federal regulation reform, lower corporate tax rates. And again, you know, that's all the Republicans know to do. There's nothing else in their mind. And you look at former Michigan Governor John Engler, who is the president of the Business Roundtable. He was one of the folks who met with the president. And look, you know, at the end of this, you know what it's all about. It's about enriching them at our expense. I don't know how you could put it any simpler. And they quoted in this article, Jim McNerney. He is the CEO of Boeing. And he said, look, the country won't be successful in repairing the economy as long as business and government are divided. Did you hear that? Not going to be successful as long as business and government are divided. Because they're trying to say that Obama's, you know, class war, the businesses need to pay more, and that's dividing us. The reality is we've got a Republican Party who's dividing us. And even he admits it. He goes, look, government itself is divided amid, you know, political partisanship. And he says, look, we can't wait till November. We need to do some things now. So their idea is, you know, more of the same. I've got some different ideas, and we've talked about that. But Dow Chemical CEO said, look, we can't afford inaction from Washington. We got to do something. And, you know, I go back to the Boeing CEO who just had to get his shots in against the National Labor Relations Board because, you know, again, you know, the CEO class, they're used to being above the law. They're used to being the head hogs because they're the ones who run the country. I don't know if you know that, but the big billionaire class and their CEOs, they really run the country. And it's amazing to me that he would come out and say, well, we need government and corporations not to be divided. Because we use government for all of our money, especially Boeing. I mean, stop and think how much money Boeing gets from the FAA. It's mind-blowing. And you look at some of these other CEOs, the Procter & Gamble CEO who threw out the other right-wing talking point that, well, the country has the highest tax rate in the world. Even though Obama has said, well, let's go back to 86 and do the Reagan thing, the tax reform bill of 86, and offer to drop it down to 28%. They said, no. We want 25. So it's never enough. It's never going to be enough for these rich people. It's never going to be enough for the righties. Never, never, never. Because they made their money off our backs. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Mike Lampham. He's from he's coordinator of the United for Fair Economy's Responsible Wealth Project. We're going to talk about his book, The Self-Made Myth, and the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. And look, you look at Perot, you look at any of these, they made their money where? Government. Pretty simple stuff. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
One place I won't be, I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In Michigan, a labor coalition, including the United Auto Workers and the Michigan Education Association, has launched a campaign called Protect Our Jobs. The goal is to protect collective bargaining rights and also to preempt any effort to make Michigan a so-called right-to-work state. Right to work is a misleading name for laws that seek to destroy or weaken unions. The Protect Our Jobs campaign says Michigan workers helped to create the middle class, and now they must protect their collective bargaining rights to rebuild their economy. The unions hope to use this campaign to collect enough petition signatures for a Michigan constitutional amendment protecting collective bargaining rights. If enough signatures are collected, the measure could be on the November ballot in Michigan. As Wisconsin prepares to rally at the state capitol in Madison once again this weekend on the anniversary of the huge 2011 pro-labor protests, the nation continues to watch this historic uprising. OPEIU International President Michael Goodwin was in Madison last March. He says the Wisconsin uprising and the recall against Governor Scott Walker is having a big impact on the national labor movement.
It woke everyone up to the reality that this can happen in my state too. So Wisconsin's fight is everybody's fight. And all the public employees around the country are looking, is my governor going to do this next? We've got to stop it right there at the water's edge, so to speak, in Wisconsin, so that it doesn't spread to other states.
Goodwin says, despite some misgivings that Obama at times hasn't done enough for workers, labor is behind his reelection. Goodwin says Obama's recent UAW speech is one sign the president is willing to be stronger for workers.
We were a little disappointed last year because we thought he was a little sluggish. He really didn't come into Wisconsin as we expected him to. But then, you know, we had a meeting with him, labor leaders, in August, and we laid out what the situation was, and he has responded. We told him that he has to be more proactive toward labor. He has to state his position, not having behind some kind of veil or something. You know, come out and state it. And surely the UAW speech was really a blockbuster speech where there's no question that President Obama is the man for the unions to get behind.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'm passionate about our economic liberty because I have witnessed our free enterprise system as it rewards the hard work of many and creates prosperity for all in this great country.
The snipers in windows taking a peek. No people panic, running scared through the street.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, the big Horatio Alger story of the day. I'm sure you've seen the Forbes magazine global billionaire list. Well, they've thrown on this Sarah Blakely, who is now, you know, she pulled herself up by her bootstraps, $5,000 investment, and now she's a billionaire. And you can do it too. And you go, really, 310 million people, one person got the golden ticket. Hey, and great for her. It was kind of a ripoff idea, to be honest, but she still got it. But the frame is there. This whole idea of, well, she made it herself. And my favorite billionaire, who made his money outsourcing jobs, they claim is self-made. So this whole frame, they've put a lot of money, a lot of effort into creating, you know, the latest, like I said, Horatio Alger vision of this country. That's why I've asked Mike Latham to come talk to us. He's the coordinator for the United for a Fair Economy's Responsible Wealth Project. He's also the co-author of the book, The Self-Made Myth, and how the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. We've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com to the book. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
You know, I look at this story today, and I couldn't have had you on at a better time. This woman, this Sarah Blakely, who's come up with this Spanx product, which I thought was just spandex. Somebody tells me, no, it's something a little different. But they're painting to her as, you know, she made it herself, and government did nothing.
Well, good for her. I mean, she came up with a good idea. I don't know whether she worked hard or not, but, you know, we should take a closer look at her story, you know, and see if in fact she was self-made. The point that we make in the book is we don't think there is any such thing, you know, that we don't think if you created a successful business in this country, you did it with some luck, some hard work, sure, but some luck, maybe some head starts, but a lot of other people's investment and a lot of investment by government in stuff that makes, that we take for granted, basically,
yep.
that you know, creates this business climate that a product like her spandex or whatever can succeed in.
Yeah, I think Elizabeth Warren said it best, the woman who's running for Senate up in Massachusetts. She mm-hmm. said nobody in this country who got rich on his own, no one did it. You built a factory and good for you, she said, but you know, I want to be clear, she said. You moved your goods to market on the roads, the rest of us paid for, you hired your workers, the rest of us paid to educate, you were safe in your factory because the police forces and the fire forces were paid for by the rest of us. You built the factory, that's a great idea, it's good, God bless, keep a huge chunk of it, but you know, you need to pay some of it for the next generation and help them out as well. And I think couldn't be better said than what she put out.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, this book is coming out at a good time. We're having a national debate about taxes. Should we roll back taxes on wealthy folks? And this myth has been used to lower taxes on particularly the upper income folks under Bush, even under Clinton when they lowered the capital gains tax on unearned income. You know, and we've kept taxes low because every time they think about raising them, they say, oh no, it's going to kill the gold, you know, the goose, the gold that laid the golden egg. You can't hurt the job creators. Those rich people need to have low taxes in order to keep investing and keep building their businesses. And it just ain't true. I mean, if you ask Warren Buffett, he'll tell you it's not true. If you look at some of the people in this book, a guy named Martin Rothenberg from upstate New York in Syracuse started Syracuse Language Systems. And if you know, he said in the 25 years I was on that management committee, they never once talked about tax rates. You know, if we made a profit, great. We're happy to pay the taxes on that. But that didn't even enter into the equation. Same with Warren Buffett. He says, I don't look at what the tax rate is before I invest. I invest if there's something good to invest in.
Yep. And if there's going to be a return, and you know, I go back to when the tax rates were higher especially during the 50s and 60s. You know, you go back and you look at the personal income tax of the upper crust, that top rate in 53 was 92%. Did it stop people from working? No.
Absolutely not. People have been making money. You know, we lowered taxes during George Bush's administration, and what happened to the economy? It was one of the worst decades in quite a long time. And, you know, it's just not it doesn't follow,
right.
You know, and what we've done also is we've said, we've made this argument, we use small business people as the poster children. The reality is it's about big business and it's about rich people whose incomes, you know, if you were in the top 1%, your income doubled in the last decade, top 0.1%, it tripled, top 0.1%, it quadrupled. So, you know, those people are doing perfectly well. And most of them have nothing to do with small business. It's just making money from money. And we're taxing them at half the rate that we're taxing people who are earning money.
Yeah, I looked at today's Forbes list of the billionaire class, and one of the guys from here from Pennsylvania, Richard Mellon Scaife, got his money the old-fashioned way. He won the sperm lottery and, you know, inherited it, you know, and good for him. And, you know, the fact that his great uncle paid a pretty sizable estate tax didn't seem to hurt him all that much.
Well, the famous oil man, John Paul Getty, said, you know, he wrote a book and he said that there's three things you need to do to get rich. And he said, first, wake up early, and a lot of us do that, work hard all day, and number three, find oil. And, you know, but the people in this book, and it's called The Self-Made Myth, It's a good title. There's this myth, and it's damaging to our society. But what we've put in this book is profiles of people. We've interviewed about a dozen entrepreneurs who are very successful in their own way, and I can talk about some of them. You know, but each of them get that there was an investment in them. And by the way, there's a website, selfmademyth.org. You can go and read some excerpts from the book, and hopefully you'll buy it. There's some great infographics and things. But you can read little snippets of these people's stories, and they say, like Jerry Fidler from Wind River Systems, he built the company that has all the embedded software in your digital camera, in the internet, in the Mars rover lander. He says, I would have never gone on to higher education. I would have never gone to graduate school if it weren't for public grants. He got, you know, a fellowship at Lawrence Berkeley Labs in California, developed this idea of embedded software, took it private, built Wind River Systems, sold it for something like $400 million, you know, to Intel. And he totally credits government with having made that innovation possible, the investment in him. You know, Martin Rothenberg went to school on the GI Bill. A lot of the people in this book really credit that public education as one of the building blocks, not only for them, but all of their employees
right. That
really make their success possible.
Yeah, and you look across the country, and what we're seeing, an attack on public education, this move to privatizing public education and profitizing it. You know, here in Pennsylvania, we got a situation where the teachers didn't get paid because they had to pay the for-profit charter school first. Which left the public school without any money, and it's an absolute shame. But you bring up an interesting point, Mike, and I look at this, and you see the people who made their money off of government, and they're out there pushing this frame that, you know, we're self-made and we didn't need government, and really pushing the anti-government frame. I look at the Koch brothers and some of them, and I wonder, does your book cover into that? Because I think that's an important frame to break.
Yeah. No, we picked a few of them. Well, there's quite a few that we could have picked. But we did, we profiled a gentleman by the name of, Donald Trump, who, fairly synonymous with the idea of a self-made man. But, you know, he had a small head start because he inherited somewhere between $40 and $200 million. So, you know, he got a little bit of a head start. But, you know, mostly he did it himself, I guess.
Well, not to mention all of the connections that come along with being a Trump.
Pardon me?
Not to mention all of the connections that come along with having the Trump name. Just like having the Bush name. That gets you into a lot of doors that Mike Lapham and Rick Smith are never getting in.
Right. I mean, George Bush is another guy who, you know, who was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. You know, and when he was running for, you know, when he was running for president, you know, first there was George Sr., who didn't even know what a checkout scanner was, because he had lived, you know, with a silver spoon in his mouth. He'd never been shopping in a supermarket, you know. And then Jr., George W. Bush, when he was running, a woman named Gwendolyn Parker wrote, she said, think of all the people's lives that he had to reinvent to believe what he believed about himself. He believed that he was the successful businessman, when in fact he had been pretty much a failure, you know, in business. But he believed that he was God's gift, and that, so therefore, the people who were not rich like him were somehow lazy or stupid or careless or, you know, and he had to reinvent all these other people's lives. And that's, the myth is, you know, dangerous enough in terms of what it means for wealthy people, but what does it mean for everyone else? The implication, the flip side of that myth is if you're not wealthy, it's through some fault of your own. And part of what we cover in this book is that, sure, there's hard work and leadership, but there's also privilege that goes in, you know, being white, being male, being born into wealth. There's total luck. You know, one of the people profiled in this book just happened upon the information that you can grow mushrooms from recycled coffee grounds. So Nikhil Arora and his buddy started a mushroom growing company, and they're now in all the Whole Foods markets around the country. You can buy these back to the roots mushroom growing kits, and you spray water. You know, so he's gotten rich or getting rich because he was in the right place at the right time.
And
you know,
and
so there's all these things and the connections that you mentioned. All of those go into giving some people a head start, and But it's not about whether you're smarter or worked harder.
And that's a frame that the right loves to throw out there. And they love to throw out there, as Romney has done time and time again, that, well, you know, you want to raise taxes. You're just punishing me for being successful. And this whole frame, well, I'm not going to apologize for being successful. And that's not what we're saying. We're saying that, you know, we're going to look to those who have the broadest shoulders, who have the ability to help get us out of the recession and get this country moving in the right direction. But they don't seem to want to do that.
No, and in fact, you know, what the result of this decision to keep taxes low on the upper income folks, and it, you know, it's costing our country, you know, billions and trillions of dollars, you know, literally, because we're keeping taxes low. And then we say we can't afford to invest in public education and in Pell Grants and in, you know, the Small Business Administration or in our infrastructure, and on down the line. There are things that we need to be, if we want a strong economy. Again, the business people profiled in this book get that we need to be investing, and they, the successful business people, Amy Dominey from Dominey Social Investments or Jim Sherbloom from Genzyme, these people get that if we're not investing in these things, if we're giving tax breaks to the rich who are putting the money offshore or whatever they're doing with it, and we're not instead investing in education and infrastructure for the next generation, then we're making a big mistake.
Absolutely. And you look at this transportation bill, which is a perfect opportunity not only to make more millionaires and billionaires, because, you know, you got private corporations who would be doing this work. It would also put people back to work and create an economy that's moving in the right direction.
We've got more than enough money. We are not poor as a country.
Oh, we're broke. Didn't you hear? I get the memo all the time. We're broke, Mike.
We're not poor. The wealthy, and you see articles about this, you know, luxury goods once again are taking off. You know, the wealthy are doing more than well, you know, and I think a lot of them, and you look at surveys, the majority of upper income folks are willing to pay more taxes, recognize that they need to pay more taxes. Are they going to do it unilaterally? Some people say, oh, you should just give your money to the government. Well, we can't have a voluntary government, but we need to realize that the time is long since past, that we need to raise more revenue, and we need it to come from the folks who have the most.
Absolutely.
And that's the least they can do to pay it forward to the next generation.
I'm right there with you. But I don't want government sponsored by ExxonMobil or my local classroom sponsored by XYZ Corporation. I think that taxes should come into the government and be doled out as the government, not in sponsorship or advertising. I mean, here locally, there's a school that's going to be putting advertisements in school buses. In the buses, not on the sides, but in them. It's just absolutely insane. Last question I've got for you, Mike Laffam. A lot of my Tea Party friends say that, well, the founders had this idea that, you know, you could make as much as you wanted, you got to keep all of it, and we encouraged, you know, the wealth class, and we encouraged people to, you know, to keep all of their money, and I don't quite remember it that way. I'm kind of wondering if you cover any of the founders' ideas in your book.
Well, we do touch on that, and you know, I think the other founder of modern capitalism is Adam Smith, who totally got that, we need to tax people according to their ability to pay and according to what they have, how they have benefited from the system. And the bigger your company, the more you have benefited from this public investment. Abigail Disney, we profile in here, who, you know, a Disney heir. You know, think of all the investment and how the roads get people to those Disneyland and Disney World, and how the patent system has protected their products and so forth on down the line. You know, Kim Jordan talks about beer being heavy and we need good roads. Anyway, there's fascinating stories in here. I urge people to check it out. There's a website, selfmademyth.org. There's some really cool infographics that we've created there. There's events around the country, hoping to make it out to Harrisburg in the months to come.
That'd be great.
But I really appreciate your having me on. This is a very important topic.
I appreciate it, Mike Laffam. The book, of course, is The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike's name. It'll take you right there. Mike, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Always great. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Every day on the job, hundreds of miners descend deep into the earth. And every time they go down, each of them wonders, will I make it back to the top today? These days, though, miners and their families are wondering if federal prosecutors will make it to the top, wondering whether justice will catch up to the top honchos of Massey Energy, who are responsible for killing 29 mine workers in a horrific methane explosion deep inside the corporation's upper Big Branch mine 2 years ago. So far, no. But even the odious former CEO of Massey, Don Blankenship, must now be having some sleepless nights, for the Justice Department has steadily been climbing up the corporate ladder. Prosecutors have gone from indicting a couple of lower-level Massey managers to now nailing Gary May, who was superintendent of Upper Big Branch when it blew. The charges against May show a corporate-wide, careless culture of profit over safety and a deliberate policy of deceiving mine safety inspectors. May allegedly directed workers to falsify official safety record books, and he used codes to warn workers that inspectors had arrived, calling out, "Bringing in a load of blocks," and "There's a hailstorm outside." So warned, workers were expected to act quickly to hide such violations of safety laws as rigging the ventilation system to make the air in the mine seem better than it really was. May is also charged with such deadly practices as ordering the rewiring of a methane monitor to keep miners working even as levels of explosive methane rose dangerously. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Superintendent May is not likely to be the Justice Department's final rung on its climb up Massey's corporate ladder, for he appears to be cooperating with prosecutors. I think we'll find that the murderous conspiracy to subvert safety laws ran all the way to the top.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Sure that there are a lot of folks who want to use the sledgehammer on Rush's head. In fact, Peter Gabriel, along with a number of other groups, have said, stop using our music, Rush. In fact, Rush was one of them. So they were saying it's a Rush on Rush violence going on. And in fact, WABC in New York, a big, big station, had a minute of dead air today because, well, there's no advertiser. The advertisers said, don't play my stuff on there. So they aired a minute of dead air during Limbaugh. I don't think anybody could have imagined that happening. And I said from the beginning, he was going to have to apologize. And had he done a real apology, I'm not so sure you would have seen this kind of outrage. But what he did was not an apology. It was nowhere near an apology. He used the word apology, didn't actually use it in its right context. And then he goes on to bash them even more and more women. And you look at this attack on women, it's what they've been talking about in their little secret clubs and their little secret societies and their think tanks. It's what they've been whispering to each other, and it just shows you how emboldened they are. And, you know, you look at what's going on in this country. You look at Wisconsin, for instance, where they wanted to add to, an amendment to one of the bills, Senate Bill 507. where they wanted to make sure that, and this Glenn Grotham, a Republican senator from Wisconsin, wants to add to their law about, you know, violence or domestic violence or educational programs to help people become aware of child abuse and neglect. They wanted to add to that these words: in promoting those campaigns and materials, the board shall emphasize non-marital parenthood as a contributing factor to abuse and neglect. And when they said, you know, in another section, disseminating information about the problems and methods of preventing child abuse and neglect, they wanted to say it again. It's because of those single parents. It's those non-married parents. And, you know, also to receive grants and subsidies or educational programs to help folks, we also need to throw in there that as well, it's those non-marital parents who are contributing to childhood abuse and neglect, and the role of the father in the primary prevention of child abuse and neglect. And I'm going, really, you threw that in there? Again, because it's a man's world in Republican world. But you got to give them credit. They stick to their guns. Absolutely stick to it. Because today they held a hearing. And I'm just scratching my head. Darrell Issa has got another oversight committee hearing. Gonna go after food stamp people because there's fraud and abuse. It's a dysfunctional system, and there's no enforcement, and it's harming the program's ability to, you know, to get after those cheaters. And the reality is in, you know, the things that they've done, there's a very small amount of fraud. What they're saying is the sum of overpayments and underpayments reached an all-time low, 3.8%. So the vast majority of people are getting what they're supposed to be getting. But again, it's just another attack, not only on government, but on women. Because women are the ones who generally get food stamps. Because they got to feed their kids. They're the ones who are saddled with the kids. And this whole argument of, well, you know, this contraception thing is, it's a moral decay. Because we want those women barefoot and pregnant, evidently. It's a control issue. It's if we can control the food that they're able to put in their kids' mouth, we can control them. And I'm going to be honest. I'm happy to see that women are waking up to the reality that they're in the sights. First it was workers. Now it's them. And as I've been telling working people, as I've been telling all of us, those of us who aren't in the wealth class, we're all in the shark tank together. At first it was, you know, first it was workers. Now it's women. Eventually, it's going to be us. We are all in the shark tank. We will all be the flavor of the month. And you look at the reality that, you know, you've got these Republicans who are going after Dodd-Frank, and, well, we can't have any oversight there. No, we don't want the big banks to be held accountable. But those welfare mothers, we're going to get them. All that waste, fraud, and abuse. And, you know, I don't seem to remember the big collapse of September of 2008 being welfare mothers. I remember it being the big banksters. The people who collapsed this economy weren't women or people trying to feed their children. No, it was these big banksters. And, you know, while some of them are going to jail, not as many as I would like to see. I would like to see a perp walk, a perpetual perp walk of every one of these people who screwed us over. And I look at today's newspaper. AP story from Leechburg, Pennsylvania. Evidently, the police charged a woman 58 years old out in western Pennsylvania for what? She was stealing newspapers. Why? Why was Linda Altman stealing newspapers? Why was this 58-year-old woman stealing newspapers? Coupons. Needed the coupons. Evidently, she's one of these people who, you know, do the extreme couponing thing. And I had a friend whose mother used to do it. She used to make a little bit of money off of it. Every coupon's worth 1/20th of a cent. And evidently, you could collect them and send them in, and they'll give you money back. I'm not making it up. I can't believe people do it, but there are folks that do. But she got busted stealing, newspapers for the last 17 months. That they're saying totaled about $2,700. So whenever the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette would drop off their papers to a local carrier, well, this 58-year-old woman would, I need the coupons. Every Wednesday they put coupons in the Wednesday paper. She's going to go to jail. Mark my words, she goes to jail. The people who screwed this economy up, the people who collapsed our economy, well, we pat them on the back and give them a bonus. What's wrong with this picture? Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about International Women's Day with Arlene Holt Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO. Right back after this. Stick around.
On the radio, with my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, how getting a good night's sleep might help your memory.
A new study by Michigan State University researchers suggests that even when you're asleep, your brain is processing information. It suggests that your brain activity when you're asleep might influence your waking memory. The Journal of Experimental Psychology published this study in September of 2011.
The researchers call what's happening in your brain during sleep your sleep memory. They say it's a new, previously undefined way of thinking about memory, the way you consolidate memories during sleep about events that happen while you're awake. They don't know yet exactly how it works.
More than 250 people took part in the study. It showed that if your sleep memory works well, your overall memory for things like reading comprehension, learning vocabulary, decision-making, and problem-solving might work well too.
But, the researchers said, the ability seems to vary among individuals. That is, you and I could get the same amount of sleep, and your memory might benefit while mine wouldn't. This isn't the first study to suggest that sleeping benefits your brain. And that's the take-home message here. According to the National Sleep Foundation, 63% of Americans say they don't get enough sleep. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So today is International Women's Day across the globe, and, you know, it highlights the fact that here in the U.S. we're working diligently, or at least a particular party funded by the billionaire class in this country are working hard at rolling back women's rights, wanting to take us back, you know, to the good old days, the good old 90s, the 1890s, that is. And, you know, it's not only women. I mean, it started off with the war on workers. Now we're seeing a war on education, a war on voters, the poor, the elderly, disabled, everyone except the wealth class. It's amazing stuff to me. That's why I've asked Arlene Holt Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, to come talk to us on this International Women's Day. Arlene, thanks for taking time for me.
Hello, Rick. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I appreciate you taking a little bit of time for me. Today, you know, being International Women's Day, I wanted to combine that with, you know, the progress that women have made in the last 100 years that our friends on the right seem to want to roll back.
Well, I tell you, we've certainly gained the right to vote, but there are some that would certainly like to take everything away from us. You've talked about it. I must say, on this International Women's Day, I am so very pleased that I am in Selma, actually speaking to you from Montgomery, Alabama at this moment, but I've been a part of the Selma to Montgomery march to bring attention to the fact that so many rights are under attack in this country, from workers' rights to voting rights to the rights of immigrants, because we don't have true comprehensive immigration reform. And in all those attacks, disproportionately, women are impacted. We see what has happened to workers in this country with the attacks, with so many of our governors who have decided instead of trying to create jobs in their states, they would try to go after workers and take away their right to bargain. But it's kind of interesting that those that disproportionately have been impacted by these attacks have been those in the public sector, and the public sector, as we know, tends to have a majority women in it, because you're talking about teachers and social workers and administrative staff. So under attack, we look at what's happening around voting rights and this attempt to take away and suppress the vote. Certainly, we're talking people, poor people, people of color, who are disenfranchised if they have their way, and there too, a majority of women would be disproportionately impacted. So it's just every attack that they've launched at us, women are going to be disproportionately impacted. But I think, Rick, the good news is, at least here in our country and quite frankly around the world, I think women are starting to wake up and speak up and speak out, that I think you're going to see women today, no matter what on the what party you are, particularly in this country, our politicians have gone absolutely too far. Our politicians and those who have the airwaves have gone absolutely too far in attacking women.
I absolutely agree with you. But, you know, the question I then have is, how much of it do you think has to do with Citizens United and all of the money that's in politics? I mean, you look at this Republican primary where, you know, each of the four candidates have their billionaire backers who are pushing the agenda. And you look at the Limbaughs, who are nothing more than the megaphone for the mega rich. And they're pushing what they've been whispering to each other, you know, in closed rooms and their little think tanks and their little secret societies for generations. They just now feel... they feel emboldened to say the things that they've been whispering.
Well, this Citizens United certainly has what it's going to basically do is it stands, or the Supreme Court made its ruling, and quite frankly, we should all be very concerned, because Citizens United threatens our very democracy. And we should not, we have to be outraged by this, because what we see happening right now, these super PACs and the multi-billionaires that can just decide that they're going to buy elections and write the $10 million checks, and they keep on writing them. And so what happens to the citizens? It's outrageous. We should be concerned, because this is so much about our democracy and trying to keep it. And so to that end, I think that we have to do what we can. I think the citizens certainly have to, despite all these obstacles of Citizens United, and we absolutely have it, but I'll tell you what we've learned in the labor movement. They've always outspent us. Yep. Always. The other side has always outspent us. But what we had as an advantage is we had people to put in the street, to knock on doors, have the conversation in the workplaces, in their communities. And we're going to have to step up our game, Rick, this year and, quite frankly, beyond to do that and show them that the 99%, no matter how much the wealth is of the 1%, that the 99%, if we do what we absolutely need to do, we can ensure that we keep our democracy. Because, quite frankly, as I said, to me, this is about making sure that we can keep democracy and let them know our democracy is not out for bid for the highest bidder.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Arlene Holt Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO. You know, you talk about being out in the streets. And this week we had seriously contemplated coming down to Alabama to partake in this, because I think it's important that people see these historic moments and see people out in the streets and the accomplishments that they made. And I guess the question I have is, you know, you go back 47 years, Bloody Sunday and the whole march, how much more forward are we today? And I guess maybe it's some would say it's a dumb question, but how much more forward are we today than we were back then, given these attacks that we're now seeing?
Well, and let me tell you, this is a visual that really has stayed with me as we've marched the last 4 days. And we're, you know, near the end of our march tomorrow. We'll have 4 more miles to go before we are at the state capitol. But we know that 47 years ago, John L. Lewis, certainly not a congressman then, but a young student and a member of SNCC, the organizing committee, he was beaten, he and others, as they attempted to cross the bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and beaten by those who should have been protecting their citizens, the law enforcement agents, the white law enforcement agents then, who beat them back, but they continued on. As we march this time, it has been just absolutely amazing as I look at the escorts who are leading us in on this march. It is diverse, but when you have walking with you, protecting you, African-American men and women, as well as whites together, I say, yes, we have come a long way. We have come an absolutely a long way. When you pass a school where children are standing to greet you as the marchers pass by, and that school is an integrated school, I say, yes, we've come a long way. But yet we still have so far to go, because there we were marching on that road 47 years ago, and it was about then primarily voting rights, the right to vote. And we're making that trek today because we've seen legislation introduced in more than 34 states in our country around these so-called voter ID laws, which are nothing but voter suppression laws, and in fact passed in 6 of the states. So here we are. Yes, we've come a long way in so many ways, but yet we're still marching for the same thing. We look at what's happening to our immigrant sisters and brothers in Alabama and Georgia and in Phoenix with these draconian laws that they introduce, and these laws of profiling immigrants. You know, if you suspect that one is undocumented, law enforcement officers are told that are required to ask and what their status is. Well, you know, you could look at somebody that looks like me. I'm brown, real brown, as a matter of fact. And would you stop and suspect that I'm undocumented? Is it right that in the state of Alabama, under HB 56, that teachers, instead of teaching, which is what they do or should be doing and are doing well, are required under this law, if they suspect that their students are undocumented, that they're to turn those students in? So, yes, some of the same issues of Jim Crow that we saw in 47 years ago, it's not so much aimed at African Americans in that sense, because we're, you know, not really separate and equal so much in some ways, but now it's being aimed at our sisters and brothers in the immigrant community. So, yes, we've come a long way, but there are those who certainly are doing everything that they can to roll us back.
Yeah, as I've said a number of times, they want to take us back to the 90s, back to the 1890s.
But guess what? We're not going. We're not going. When you look, and this march symbolizes it, it's working people on this march of every color. There are immigrants on this march, children on this march, certainly women. And again, you know, women, we always step up. A large percentage of the march are women. And those who love justice, our civil rights leaders and community leaders, have joined us. So when you think about working people, you think about the civil rights community, women leaders will be joining us on Friday. The women's movement, the labor movement, the immigrant movement, and all of us who believe in justice. That's a mighty powerful coalition if we stay together.
Yep.
If we stay together.
That's absolutely the key, because the wealth class has always figured out how to slice and dice us, white, black, blue collar, white collar, union, non-union, you name it. They've figured out subcategories to keep us all in so that we don't come together, we don't meet in the street and pursue them, really.
Well, divided, you know, we certainly will fall divided. We will see more and more if legislation that will attempt to take away the rights of workers, take away our voting rights, and move us to do more draconian anti-immigration legislation in states as opposed to real comprehensive immigration reform. We will see more of that if we don't stay united. Quite frankly, we've elected, you know, politicians certainly in so many ways in 2010, we kind of sat back. People didn't go. They didn't go out because they were angry at whatever. But we better get it that elections absolutely matter. You can never let up because at the end of the day, it's bigger than any election. It's about policy. It's about policy. So if women, and as I said, all of us who believe in equality and justice, realize that we have an opportunity to move our country forward and not backward. And if we haven't learned, especially from this last year, God help us, because they've come after every one of us. And I tell you, this in the last few weeks, this attack on women, I've thought at times I couldn't believe what I've been hearing.
Yep.
I couldn't believe it, Rick. But then I said, I realized what we're dealing with here, and these folks have gone over the top. They've overreached, and it's up to us to, they want to keep us in our place. It's time for us to make sure that they know that we're keeping them in theirs. And that's, at the end of the day, that's what we've got to do.
Absolutely.
Our place is moving our country forward. Our place is making sure there's social and economic justice, and our place is making sure that everyone in this country can have the American dream of a good job, a home, and the ability to educate their children.
Amen. I am right there with you. You look at all of these attacks. You know, we've ticked them off: workers, children, the poor, voters, the elderly, disabled, the whole nine yards, and just fast and furious and well funded. We're all in the shark tank, as you pointed out, Arlene. And I appreciate the time. Come talk to us, and best of luck tomorrow on the final leg of the historic march.
The struggle continues, but the victory will be ours.
Yeah, right there with you. I'd love to have you back again sometime in the near future. Thanks so much.
Look forward to it.
Thanks a lot. Arlene Holt-Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why.
For the rest of us, Rick Smith.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here. here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. So it's about the jobs, 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 jobs. At least that's what the Republicans told us in November of 2010. Haven't seen much in the way of creation of jobs. Not so much. A lot of division, a lot of attacks, especially like we talked about with Arlene Holt Baker. Those workers, those women, those disabled people, those poor people, those voters. You know, all those people that the right despises. All of those groups that the investor class, well, they're just extra costs. And we don't need those costs. They're bad for profit. But here again, nothing on the jobs front. So I looked at Larry Flint, who I saw this yesterday, just caught my eye. Larry Flint is going to create at least one job. And I'm sure some more, because I'm sure a lot of people are going to get out there with their shovel and start digging. He has offered in a full-page newspaper ad in Sunday's paper $1 million for any indiscretions made by well-known U.S. politicians or government officials. It appeared in the Washington Post and said, look, you know, here's a phone line. You can tell us what it is. If we verify it and we get to the bottom of it, we're going to give you $1 million. There are, I'm sure, a lot of conservative Republicans going, uh-oh, what have I been doing? Better get my little tryst in line. And I guess, you know, you might as well keep them looking. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Anyway, today, and I look at this Keystone XL thing, and I've said for the longest time, look, if you could prove to me that it wasn't going to raise prices, you could prove to me that it was going to benefit this nation in any way, I would be full and in favor of it. You know, this idea that, well, it's just going to create some short-term jobs, I don't know. I don't know that I buy that. That's not enough to cause the environmental problems. Not to mention it should be moved to be in a less pristine area. There's a whole bunch of discussion about that. But look, if you could prove to me it was going to help this nation, I think I'd be okay with it. And you look at Ron Wyden, Senator from Oregon, who has an amendment to the Senate's highway funding bill. Now the Republicans, they just want to see this Keystone XL thing go because, you know, it's the billionaires want it. The oil people want it. They say, look, okay, I'm with you. But the amendment is, look, if you bring it in here, it's got to stay here. Or at least some of it. Guarantee to us as a nation that there's going to be something in this that's going to help this country. Because right now, understand, the Keystone XL project is going to take oil from Canada, going to ship it right down the middle of the country to a free trade zone in Texas, and it's going to end up out into the international community. We're not going to be able to tax it anywhere along the journey because, as I understand, and as people have told us, it's in a free trade zone. That's free. It's like international land. And we've got a lot of these around the country. Understand, we've set up these, which is what the Herman Cain plan was kind of doing, saying going into these inner cities and saying, okay, this is a free trade zone. Business, do whatever you want. There are no labor laws. There are no rules. You know, that pesky minimum wage, nah, never mind. So Wyden's just saying, you know what, it's got to benefit this country first. And, you know, I go back to the McCain rhetoric and the McCain signs and the bumper stickers that at least if you're going to use the bumper sticker slogan, at least, well, live it, at least. I mean, if you thought it up, you should at least be part of your actual policy. So this idea of country first, kind of not a bad idea, don't you think? And Wyden's bill is saying, look, okay, you build the thing. It's got to be made with American steel. We need to strengthen some of our some of our, you know, the Buy American provisions. So all of the, because understand, the Canadian company, that's, they've already contracted most of this stuff to the Chinese. But they're saying, look, if you're going to build it here, it's got to benefit us in more ways than just, oh, you're splitting our nation in half with a pipeline. You know, all of the manufactured goods need to be made here. The labor's got to be done with workers from here. You got to pay a reasonable wage, so it actually helps communities. So that's going to get shot down, and you know it's going to. Understand, it's going to. So the Republicans were debating one of their jobs bills, their so-called jobs bill. And understand what it's going to do is it's going to give small businesses, and this is the proposal that the Republicans have thrown out, it's going to give small businesses an extra 20% tax deduction. And what they're saying is now what chances are what's going to happen is you're going to see this 20% tax deduction end up into the hands of these multi-billion dollar hedge funds. These big law firms and really these big enterprises who make tons of money but have very few employees. In fact, every business, Cantor's office says, every business with fewer than 500 employees will be able to deduct 20% of their profits. Now, the earlier version didn't have this in it. They've tucked this in neatly. Now, understand, 500 employees is a lot of employees. So you can set up a little hedge fund. You know, David Tepper himself made $4 billion on one bet. So there's one guy. He's a small business. We're going to give him an extra 20% because he's a small business. That's what they're telling us. And you look at what Bob McIntyre of Citizens for Tax Justice said. He said, look, you know, the earlier version of the bill would have prevented this from happening, would have prevented the big handouts to the finance industry. He said, they're just trying to cut taxes for people with a lot of money. And that's what they always do. That's what they are. And the reality is, we know this. And we've known it all along. But you look at this stuff and it's going, well, yeah, of course I know. So why do we vote for these people? Why do we put these people in power? Makes absolutely no sense to me. No sense whatsoever. I mean, you look at the average... You know, even in the worst part of the Great Recession, the average hedge fund manager, the average hedge fund employee made $800,000. We're going to give them 20% tax breaks? Are you kidding me? At a time when the nation's supposedly in deep trouble and we're broke? Sorry, Mr. Smith, your children can't get an education. We're going to need to beg from XYZ Corporation so we can put ads in the buses. And we need to beg from ABC Corporation so we can put ads on desks and on report cards and on their lockers and on their books and on the blackboard and on their bookcases. You know, we just need to, every classroom will look like a NASCAR event. Every school bus will look like a NASCAR, the pace car for NASCAR. That's where we're heading. And it's insane. But it's what we're told. Oh, well, you know, we can't raise taxes. Oh, gee, we can't ask anything from those people who have done wildly well. No, that would hurt job creation. Yet we know, we've seen study after study, we've seen the facts. All you had to do was live through the Bush years. If cutting taxes was the panacea, if handing more and more to the 1%, handing just more to the wealth class, if that was the panacea, if that was utopia, if that was the best we can do, and that was going to create jobs, it would have. But 2000 to 2008, are you kidding me? I don't know anybody who lived through those 8 years who said, yes, those were the best years in the country. But we sure had a lot of money to go play in the sandbox, didn't we? And we're paying the cost right now. Because now you got the righties going, well, Obama's raised the debt. He's raised the debt. Yeah, because he didn't have a choice. It doesn't matter who's in the White House right now. Someone had to dig out of the mess left to us by the cons. Someone had to dig that mess up. And I think Hillary Clinton had it right when she was running, while making the case for her to be president. You know, it seems like you always need a Clinton to come in to clean up after a Bush. And, you know, you look what her husband did after George H.W. Bush. Huge mess that we were in. And we handed to another Bush. I'm telling you, trouble, trouble, trouble if we end up with a Republican in November. Quick break, right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In Michigan, a labor coalition, including the United Auto Workers and the Michigan Education Association, has launched a campaign called Protect Our Jobs. The goal is to protect collective bargaining rights and also to preempt any effort to make Michigan a so-called right-to-work state. Right to work is a misleading name for laws that seek to destroy or weaken unions. The Protect Our Jobs campaign says Michigan workers helped to create the middle class, and now they must protect their collective bargaining rights to rebuild their economy. The unions hope to use this campaign to collect enough petition signatures for a Michigan constitutional amendment protecting collective bargaining rights. If enough signatures are collected, the measure could be on the November ballot in Michigan. As Wisconsin prepares to rally at the state capitol in Madison once again this weekend on the anniversary of the huge 2011 pro-labor protests, the nation continues to watch this historic uprising. OPEIU International President Michael Goodwin was in Madison last March. He says the Wisconsin uprising and the recall against Governor Scott Walker is having a big impact on the national labor movement.
It woke everyone up to the reality that this can happen in my state, too. So Wisconsin's fight is everybody's fight. And all the public employees around the country are looking, is my governor going to do this next? We've got to stop it right there at the water's edge, so to speak, in Wisconsin, so that it doesn't spread to other states.
Goodwin says, despite some misgivings that Obama at times hasn't done enough for workers, labor is behind his reelection. Goodwin says Obama's recent UAW speech is one sign the president is willing to be stronger for workers.
We were a little disappointed last year because we thought he was a little sluggish. He really didn't come into Wisconsin as we expected him to. But then, you know, we had a meeting with him, labor leaders, in August, and we laid out what the situation was, and he has responded. We told him that he has to be more proactive toward labor. He has to state his position, not having behind some kind of veil or something, you know, come out and state it. And surely the UAW speech was really a blockbuster speech where there's no question that President Obama is the man for the unions to get behind.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hard-working men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
American workers versus multi-billionaires. The middle class versus multi-billionaires. A corporation get billions in welfare and millions in this country been out of work for years.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So the Koch brothers, not happy. Not happy whatsoever with their... I thought Cato was an offspring of one of them. I thought it was the Charles Koch Institute or something along those lines before it became the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. Here's the problem. From the way I understand it, Cato is actually stuck to their libertarian views, you know, call them what they want, say that they're nuts, whatever, but at least they're semi-consistent. Koch brothers, not so happy with that. They don't conform to the Koch views. So I guess they're suing them, trying to take control, which is why I've asked Lee Fong. He is a senior researcher with United Republic, unitedrepublic.org, the website. Lee, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, how are you doing?
I'm good. So what's going on here? I mean, as I remember, and maybe I'm wrong, but wasn't this the Koch Institute or something like that?
Well, it's a complicated history. You know, Charles Koch has had many feuds. This billionaire, you know, head of Koch Industries, many feuds throughout his life. So he started the Cato Institute in the late 70s and actually named it after himself, the Charles Koch Institute. But the president, Ed Crane, had a falling out with Charles in 1991. So Charles dropped off the board. His brother David went on the board. Charles stopped giving money. David started giving money. And overall, you know, the Kochs have given some $20 or $30 million to the foundation. But what's happening now, because of a weird legal structure of the think tank, because one of the shareholders, the original shareholders of the Cato Institute recently passed away, Charles Koch is back, and he's doing basically a hostile takeover to retake the Cato Institute and to basically remake it in his own image.
So no more libertarian values. And then we can argue libertarianism and that whole ideology, but this sounds more like he just wants, you know, his own little world and pushing his little bizarre views, which I guess, you know, you look at the presidential race, they've all got their own billionaire backers pushing their own specific little agenda.
Yeah, and, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, Charles Koch calls himself a libertarian. He actually made up his own ideology. It's called the science of liberty, whatever that means. if you actually look at what Koch Industries does, look at their behavior, they're not libertarian. You know, they've demanded bailouts after bailout. I mean, they've asked the Alaskan government to basically bail out one of their refineries up there. They've asked the federal government for huge multi-million dollar contracts. They've used eminent domain, seizing private land to build their pipelines throughout the Midwest. And the biggest thing is that, you know, they had a lot of crony capitalism with the Bush administration. You know, after we invaded Iraq, some of the first oil contracts, guess who they were given to?
Fisheries. Absolutely. And, you know, the eminent domain thing is a huge issue with all the libertarian people I know. Most of my friends who call themselves libertarian, big on the property rights. Wish the Constitution would have been, wished it had been life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. I mean, the Declaration of Independence. Wish it had been that instead of happiness. They want private property.
Well, and I think the bigger issue here, too, is that Charles Koch and David Koch, you know, they have their own agenda. They just want to beat Obama. That's all they care about. And they're actually on the record. They met with the Cato Institute board and said, you know what? We don't care about your libertarian values. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. All we want to do is beat Obama this year. And the Cato Institute, you know, a lot of folks on the left won't agree with everything they say. But at least, like you said, they're consistent. They're, you know, against war. They're against government spying. They're against torture. You know, they're for gay marriage, for immigration reform. And most problematic for folks like Romney, you know, the Kochs love Romney. They actually point out that Romney care is essentially the exact same thing as Obamacare. They actually do a better job of pointing out the similarities between Obamacare and Romney care than I think the DNC. They made all these videos. They actually have a website going explaining the similarities just because, you know, they're principled libertarians. And, you know, the Koch brothers don't want these, you know, pesky voices on the right. They want everyone lock, stock, and barrel just attacking Obama.
Yeah, so it's not about ideology then. It's just about pure power.
Yeah, it's power. You have it exactly right. And they don't care, you know, about the drug war and these other things that Cato has a very principled voice on. They just want to have, you know, these little talking points. And you know these groups. You know Americans for Prosperity. They want to turn the Cato Institute into one of their groups that they just control. You know, these Tea Party groups that they use to, you know, lobby, to organize and to elect, you know, crony capitalist neocon Republicans.
Well, what worries me, and, you know, and I keep hearing the, you know, I look at the Republican nominees right now, the saber rattling with Iran, and I think the worst thing that could happen to this country, especially right now, is some type of conflict over there that we get sucked into. And Cato, as you pointed out, one of those groups out on the saying, no, this would be a bad idea, bad for the nation, bad for us all around. But there are folks, you know, I look at Adelson, I look at some of the others, kind of pushing us in that direction.
It's quite scary. And, you know, again, you know, Cato has been good on his dash. One of their top fellows had a great op-ed about how the nuclear threat from Iran is exaggerated in the New York Daily News today. So, I mean, it's refreshing for me because you look at all the other big right-wing think tanks that take Koch money, like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation. They're beating the drums of war, and this is dangerous. This is not only going to be disastrous for our economy in terms of shooting up gas prices, but it's going to lead to a lot of bloodshed. And I think if anyone, if you care about life, if you care about human life, if you care about human rights, war should be off the table.
Yeah, where are my pro-life people then? And, you know, I go back and, you know, I go back to Smedley Butler because, you know, and I encourage everyone to read War is a Racket. It's a quick, you know, 15-minute read. But, you know, he goes back, you know, World War One and talks about who made the billions of dollars. And, you know, the basic premise being, you know, the wealth class, the Kochs, the Scapes, the billionaires, they make money off of war. It's you and me. It's the poor. We're the ones who shed blood and die over it.
The DuPont family who ripped off the taxpayers in World War One, and then went on to use those millions of dollars to smear and try to get rid of FDR, they're almost identical in my view to what the Koch brothers are doing today to Obama. Obviously not exactly the same, but there are very interesting parallels when you look back at history.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And you think about where we are in history, and you think about, you know, just how the idea that history continues to repeat itself, and it's, you know, maybe not different names, but it's the same characters. I mean, you go back to Father Coughlin and a lot of that, and you got Lintball and these other megaphones for the mega rich. It just never seems to change.
And, you know, Glenn Beck is close to the Koch brothers. So, you know, there you go. I mean, just to kind of match up your comparison there. You know, and again, Glenn Beck is not a libertarian. Why is he cozying up with the Koch brothers if they're supposedly libertarian? He's the one who was cheerleading for the Iraq War all those years of the Bush administration. So, I mean, I got to tell you, you know, my good colleague, Zed Jelani, who's also at United Republican, our blog, Republic Report, he's actually helping to organize a protest outside of Koch Industries lobbying office next Tuesday. You know, and obviously a lot of folks in the Occupy movement on the left won't agree with everything that Cato does, but this is just a protest that he's organizing to bring people together and say, let's stand up for intellectual integrity. Let's stop the hostile takeover. And just come together and realize that, you know, I think we all lose if Cato is destroyed and taken over by the Koch brothers.
Yeah, I mean, and what bothers me is, you know, I talk to folks all the time, and they say, well, you know, I got this fact from this group. There doesn't seem to be anyone who is purely principled anymore. They all have an agenda, in my opinion, just to accumulate and consolidate power into their funders' hands.
I mean, for me, you know. I, you know, it's complex. I don't like boiling things to talking points, but, you know, competition matters, and you have to have some type of market force for real competition. And what a lot of these Koch-funded conservatives really advocate is not a real free market. What they want is a monopoly. So they monopolize a lot of industries and their business practices, and now you look at the political sphere, now they're trying to monopolize all the voices in terms of think tanks, intellectuals, people who are making ideas and writing policy. So it's a monopoly. They're not actually trying to spur, you know, a free market of ideas. They're trying to take ideas and put them in the private domain.
Yeah. What do you think the chances are of the Kochs taking over Cato? I know they've got a lawsuit going and they're gonna try. What do you think the chances of that happening are?
Well, Rick, I've looked at the court case, and they actually have a pretty strong argument. You know, if they can take those shares of that recently deceased shareholder of the Cato Institute, they take over those shareholders, it's done. They own 75% of the Cato Institute. They can appoint another six or seven or four or five board members. They already are one board member away from owning half of the boards. So they're two board members away from an outright majority. It seems pretty likely, but we'll have to see.
So now you're the guy who, you're the person I would talk to about the Koch brothers. And I don't know that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about them. And I don't think the average person, you know, understands just how powerful these guys are in right-wing circles and how much money they put into this. And, you know, one of the things that I keep talking about is education. You know, what's amazing to me is how little money they've given to all of these different universities and colleges to set up these little think tanks that put out this well, attack nonsense. I look at, what is it, the place at George Mason. I look at, you know, a whole bunch of these colleges that have these little groups, and really for very little money.
It's astounding, but, you know, with particularly public schools just being absolutely assaulted in terms of their budgets being cut and staff being laid off, it provides an opportunity for companies like Coke. You know, it's not just Coke. You know, Dow Chemical and BP, they're going in and buying up professors too. But, you know, Coke is very savvy in this. They're coming in, like you said, with just a little bit of money, a million here, $500,000 there, maybe even just $100,000 at another university, and they're pregnating these universities with their ideas. And if you look at Florida State University, you know, faced a lot of budget cuts,
yep,
took a big Coke grant. In the contract, it said the Charles Koch Foundation, or Charles Koch nonprofit group up in Virginia, got to vet the professors before they hired them.
Now, I've talked about that quite frequently because it's just amazing to me that a school that size, and if I remember the amount of money, it was like $2.5 million, which isn't, for a university that size, isn't a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just the world we live in. When these schools are under assault, they'll take money from anywhere, and it's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, and this whole circular process of putting out the message and politicians pushing for lower taxes and less government and lower taxes and smaller government, look what we've got. I mean, this is the world that we've allowed to be created right in front of us.
Well, we've got one battle coming up, and, you know, and again, I don't agree with a lot of the things Cato puts out. You know, they basically think corporations are people. They want to assault unions. They want to cut taxes for corporations. I don't like any of that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But that being said, they're consistent, and this is a fight that's coming up in the next week, and people should pay attention to, because this is a war all across the country, a war for intellectual independence, and this is just the next front.
And if you want to read more about it, they've got it over at unitedrepublic.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Lee Fong's name. He's a senior researcher over at United Republic. Lee, it's always great talking with you. Always good information.
Likewise. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks
for
so much.
Me.
Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
10% of the world. 10% of the people. 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Every day on the job, hundreds of miners descend deep into the earth. And every time they go down, each of them wonders, will I make it back to the top today? These days, though, miners and their families are wondering if federal prosecutors will make it to the top, wondering whether justice will catch up to the top honchos of Massey Energy, who are responsible for killing 29 mine workers in a horrific methane explosion deep inside the corporation's upper Big Branch mine 2 years ago. So far, no. But even the odious former CEO of Massey, Don Blankenship, must now be having some sleepless nights. For the Justice Department has steadily been climbing up the corporate ladder. Prosecutors have gone from indicting a couple of lower-level Massey managers to now nailing Gary May, who was superintendent of Upper Big Branch when it blew. The charges against May show a corporate-wide, careless culture of profit over safety and a deliberate policy of deceiving mine safety inspectors. May allegedly directed workers to falsify official safety record books, and he used codes to warn workers that inspectors had arrived, calling out, "Bringing in a load of blocks," and "There's a hailstorm outside." So warned, workers were expected to act quickly to hide such violations of safety laws as rigging the ventilation system to make the air in the mine seem better than it really was. May is also charged with such deadly practices as ordering the rewiring of a methane monitor to keep miners working even as levels of explosive methane rose dangerously. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Superintendent May is not likely to be the Justice Department's final rung on its climb up Massey's corporate ladder, for he appears to be cooperating with prosecutors. I think we'll find that the murderous conspiracy to subvert safety laws ran all the way to the top.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown.
From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
What they do, they smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place, the backstab.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast is there, or you can download the Stitcher app on your smartphone and take the program on the go. And, you know, last segment we talked about Smedley Butler, and I think about that piece, War as a Racket, quite often. Because, you know, every time I hear the saber rattlers, every time I hear the people saying, oh, we need war, I go, well, who's going to benefit this time? And I think back to Smedley Butler's quote. He said, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active duty military service. And during that period, I spent most of my time as high-class muscle for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. He said, in short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for the American oil interests. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys so that they could collect revenues. I helped in raping a half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers, Bush's relative, old man Prescott. He says, I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests. I helped make Honduras right for the American Fruit Company, and in China, I helped to see that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. You know, he said at one point, Al Capone may have controlled 3 counties in Chicago. He said he controlled 3 continents. And that's what we've used our military for. So every time I hear this saber rattling, and every time I hear this, we need war! I go, well, you know, somebody's going to benefit. We're going to make billionaires out of this. And the billionaires that are made out of this, and this is the ironic part to me. This is the part that just leaves me scratching my head. The very same people who make the billions off of our government through war or however else, they're the very people who are out there saying, we need smaller, less intrusive government. Yeah. So that they can have more control. They can have more power. They can have more say. They can have their way. And you and I and all the rest of the little peons, all of the worker bees, you just do your job and shut up or we're going to make your life miserable. And don't ever think about collective bargaining and don't ever think about joining a union. And don't ever thinking about asking for any of that pie because it's ours. Because it's our natural right. It's the natural law. You hear the cons talk about this all the time. Survival of the fittest. I screw you and you are helpless to fight against me. That's what it comes down to. It doesn't get any simpler than that. I'm bigger than you and I'm going to take from you and tough luck. And they'll do what they can do to keep us divided. They'll do what they can do to keep us at each other's throat. Why? Because they know if we unite, they know. Because history has proven this. You look at the labor movement of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where they grew a massive middle class, where a truck driver could sit in the same restaurant with the guy who owned the building. They don't want that. They don't want that at all. What they want is they want obedient little worker bees. They want people who aren't going to question. They want people who are going to push the buttons and do the work and bust their behinds and take their pittance home and attempt to eke out an existence. And I talk to so many working people every day who say, you know what, I'm working hard. And I'm on that treadmill and I'm working and I'm just getting by. But if gas prices go up, I don't know what I'm going to do. If the cost of college goes up, I don't know what I'm going to do. If health care goes up, don't know what I'm going to do. If I get sick or my children get sick or my wife gets sick, don't know what I'm going to do. Because there's no floor under our feet. There's no net there. There's nothing to catch us in times of trouble. And that's where they want us. They want us desperate. They keep throwing out this, oh, well, we're a nation of individuals and we're independent and all that. And they've really done a nice job of rewriting history. They want you to believe that, you know, one guy walked out across the woods and, you know, he settled the next town. No, it was hundreds of people in caravans. But we don't want to talk about that because it doesn't fit the Horatio Alger frame. It doesn't fit the pull yourself up by your bootstraps frame. No, doesn't do that at all. So when you really think about what's gone on in this country over the last 30 years, you've seen the emergence, and the Forbes number today really bears that out. The massive redistribution of wealth from the people who actually do the labor to the people who just came up with the gimmick is mind-blowing. It's staggering. And I want people to do well. I want people to be successful. But what we've seen, especially since the collapse, as we've seen those at the very top who have the resource to come in like vultures and suck up what's left over, pick from the bones, while the rest of us are just trying to get to our feet. We've seen that 93% of the income gains from 2009 to 2010 went to the top 1%. 93%! I don't know how anyone can look at that and say, you know what, there's not a problem going on. And I hear my T-Twizzler friends, well, Rick, you and that Obama, you're talking about redistributing wealth. And I go, you're damn right I am. I want it redistributed the way it was back when my grandfather was working. And through his working life. You know, I was thinking about this the other night as I was in Cleveland for a friend's funeral. A friend's mother's funeral. And I was thinking about my grandmother and the house that she's in. 44 years ago, they bought that house for $18,000. It's not worth, $150,000 or whatever it's worth. Their mortgage payments were like, I think it was like 60 bucks or something out, something minuscule like that. By 15 years into their, I guess it was like by 10 years into their mortgage, in 77, that was what one person was making before lunch. And I think about a lot of folks that I know who have $1,500 mortgages, have $2,000 mortgages, and I go, you know, are we ever going to get to a time like my grandparents had where you saw their mortgage being pennies on what they earned because wages had kept up with inflation? I mean, understand, we've had inflation since 1980, but the wages have been stagnant. And that was because we decoupled productivity and wages. And how did that happen? Well, that happened because they broke the unions. And I go back to the idiot that I wanted to drown in the hot tub, telling me, well, we're going to move this plant from Cleveland to Texas to get rid of that union. And then the more you talk to them, the more you realize, well, they want to just get rid of people in general. They don't want workers. They're going to mechanize most of the plant. And they got a ton of money from the state. So you go, well, explain to me how getting rid of the union, how that was going to play into your move when you're going to mechanize and take money from the state. That had nothing to do with it. But it's the talking point that they feed to these people, and it's how they divide us. Because it makes for a nice rant. Well, they're lazy. They take a break. And I almost flipped when he said, I asked him, I said, well, how often do they take a break? Once every 2 hours. Do you believe that? I'm going, oh, heaven forbid. Heaven forbid all those studies that say people are more productive when they're rested. You know, even if you take a 10-minute break, just a small break here or there, to catch your breath and to clear your mind, lowers accident rates, lowers injury rates, increases quality, better productivity, but, you know, never mind that. Because down in Texas, according to him, a break every 10 hours. And I said, it'll be great when we can finally do away with all those pesky labor laws, get rid of a minimum wage, make them work for a buck a day, or better yet, give a bowl of soup. Because we learned during the Depression, we'll work for food wasn't low enough. So how much farther do we have to go down? How much more, how much worse does it have to get? And I got to be honest, I'm just scratching my head. Because I hear people who've bought into that for all the unions are bad. Why? Well, because they want to protect their members. So why do you not want someone who's going to help protect your rights? I mean, stop and think about it. In this country, we've got a right to an attorney, but we don't have a right to a representative at work. We have a right to an attorney, but we don't have a right to a doctor. Explain that to me, because I'm having a real hard time with it. Are we turning into a prison culture where I've got more rights as someone going to jail? I've got more opportunity. I've got better opportunity for a job being in prison than I do as a law-abiding citizen. Is that what they're telling me? And you look at Alabama and Georgia, who want to use prison labor. You look at other states that are. California actually uses prison labor. You look at Minnesota. One of the catalogs they have up there that takes their orders. Airline flights being booked by prisoners. You got a better chance of going to work in prison. That's how they like it. And until we wake up and get our heads out of the sand and stop dividing each other with nonsense issues, they're going to keep stealing from us. And these Forbes numbers, and I encourage you to take a look at them, these Forbes numbers, just mind-blowing. They went from $295 billion of total wealth for the billionaire class to $4.6 trillion. Whose money did that come out of? Whose pockets did that come out of? Came out of yours. Came out of mine. Came out of every person who didn't see an increase in their salary from 1987 until today. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, how getting a good night's sleep might help your memory.
A new study by Michigan State University researchers suggests that even when you're asleep, your brain is processing information. It suggests that your brain activity when you're asleep might influence your waking memory. The Journal of Experimental Psychology published this study in September of 2011.
The researchers call what's happening in your brain during sleep your sleep memory. They say it's a new, previously undefined way of thinking about memory, the way you consolidate memories during sleep about events that happen while you're awake. They don't know yet exactly how it works.
More than 250 people took part in the study. It showed that if your sleep memory works well, your overall memory for things like reading comprehension, learning vocabulary, decision-making, and problem-solving might work well too.
But the researchers said the ability seems to vary among individuals. That is, you and I could get the same amount of sleep, and your memory might benefit while mine wouldn't. This isn't the first study to suggest that sleeping benefits your brain. And that's the take-home message here. According to the National Sleep Foundation, 63% of Americans say they don't get enough sleep. I'm Deborah Byrd.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. You look at what's going on in D.C., the jobs bills are just look like handouts to the wealthy again. Not much in the way of getting people actually back to work. But no surprise there. Anyway, Talk Radio News Service, I got Bob Nye on the line. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, hey, nice to be on your show. Ellen Ratner, my friend and boss and your friend, was supposed to try to call in, but I think the sun flares are causing problems with their satellite phone.
Yeah, I mean, she's up in Antarctica, and I was really looking forward to seeing what's going on up there because, that's really the heartbeat of what's going on the globe. If that whole thing melts, I think we're in big trouble.
That's what she was saying. you were talking about the jobs bill. There was a little floor meltdown on the jobs bill, and it was between Barney Frank, a Democratic member from Massachusetts, and Jeb Hensarling, a conservative Republican member from Texas. And they actually brought up an amendment by Dan Quayle's son, who's a congressman, and it was not a problem of substance. Everybody agreed on it. But a Democrat had been proposing this amendment, I guess, for about a year. Barney Frank questioned, you know, why do you bring up Quayle's and you didn't do that one? And then he and Hensarling got into it, and he said something about deceitful, and they were going to take his words down, and they were going to have a vote on not allowing him to speak for a day, meaning Barney Frank. And finally it all got solved. But, you know, a lot of drama, honestly, over a bill that I think you termed it so accurate. There's not a lot of punch to this bill. There's really not. These are some agreed-to things that, and they had an amendment about the banks and the SEC and, you know, nothing to write home about.
And nothing to have these kind of squabbles and fights over. And this is what I think the reason they've got a 10% approval rating, because the American public is looking at this going, look, just do your job. Stop with the partisanship. Stop with the bickering. Do something. I mean, the transportation bill, in my view, is bipartisan. I mean, you look at the guy from the Republican from Ohio, your former colleague, Stephen LaTourette,
yes,
who said, look, every $1 billion we spend on infrastructural improvement, that's 42,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. He gets it. I know the Republican Party gets it. Why can't we get a decent transportation bill?
I was on the transportation committee with Steve LaTourette, and I've got to tell you, we had the most bipartisan bills that a human being could get, and you're dividing up money, and you really want to get into political fights, divide up money. But, you know, we had nonpartisan bills. We really did. Now, there were those who don't believe in, you know, doing the bill at all. That's fine. Now, a simple bill, and by the way, it has to be, you know, and I try to explain this to people, it has to be like a five-year bill. They're only making it a one-year bill. You can't plan anything. Your people can't. Our people can't in multiple states. You can't plan something on a one-year basis on a highway bill. You got engineering and design, things like that. So I think it's broken down horribly to the fact that you can't even get a highway bill, which used to be, you know, the easiest thing to pass.
Yeah, would you want to be in Congress right now? I mean, I look at what's going on in this bickering. I'm not surprised that Olympia Snow has left it. I'm not surprised that Barney Frank wants out.
It's a good question, because when a former congressman who lost is running against the current one in my old district, they recarved the district to go back to the Democrat way it was, which I won as a Republican. It's a good seat for me, to be honest with you. And I had a lot of people that called me, and they said, you ought to run. I know you've had this whole thing and went to prison, but you ought to run. And, you know, for a minute, I thought, And then I turned on the TV, and they're bickering at 1 o'clock in the morning. I decided, no, I'd rather sit on my couch and watch them bicker.
Yeah, I mean, who wants that? I mean, and the problem is, to me, then you end up not encouraging good, decent people who really want to be public servants and who really want to make this country the best we possibly can be. You got them people saying, you know what, I'm going to do just like Bob Ney would do. I'm going to sit on the couch.
Yeah, it's really bad. It used to be at least a bit better on people cooperating on the big deal, because the economy's bad, the gasoline's bad, the housing market's down. You would think this would force more people to do something together versus the polarization.
Well, let me ask you this. How much of it do you blame on the electorate? I mean, because, you know, in 2010, we as a nation really put in some pretty extreme ideology, some pretty extreme folks who really don't believe in government. And I guess there's this thought there that, and I don't understand it, but I'm going to elect a guy who doesn't believe in government, who wants to shrink it and destroy it to keep it in check. I kind of understand. I don't agree with it, but I kind of understand it. But we saw that in November of 2010, and now we're reaping the benefits with gridlock and more of this fighting.
That's a really good question. I think it goes back to where I call it the syndrome from up above. And I would see members that would say, I'm not voting for this bill because my people mandated me here. Well, he didn't check. People are fluid. People are fickle. People change their minds. And if you're a leader, you've got to be, if you're driving the bus, you've got to look back once in a while. But if you look back all the time, you're going to crash. And so I think they respond to the electorate, and then they don't really read the electorate anymore, and they let a few pull their chain. You got to keep reading people and get out amongst them. They do, you know, change their minds, or maybe you know something they don't. Yeah. And you bring it to their attention.
And speaking of pulling their chain, I'm sure there's a lot of billionaire money in the, you know, you look at these super PACs and the money that goes into this stuff. I'm sure they're reading their pulse quite often.
And that's the problem. You know, there was a guy from Texas, I forget his name. He got into two of our elections here in Ohio. One is Dennis Kucinich's election, and he got into a Republican election. He likes to defeat incumbents. And that's fine. It's a free country, but you look at, you know, one rich guy who can throw around and get around the rules, really, that you and I can't get around, and can throw millions of dollars around, and it's really an abuse of power. It's not an equity thing of versus other citizens and their ability.
Yeah, I would think as a Republican you would be against that as well, because eventually they get, as you've said, fickle, and they swing the other way, and
sure.
You know, that double edge of the sword.
And John McCain was going to clean all this up, and honestly, he created loopholes, the 527s. Now, somebody might like George Soros, and somebody might like the Swift boats, but the fact remains that after McCain, quote, took the money out of politics, which he didn't, these 527s and now the super PACs, the creative funds, and the Supreme Court decision on United, obviously, all comes into play to create a playground for a few.
And that's just amazing to me. You got a billionaire playing politics in Ohio. I guess I can understand it.
They can do it, so they will.
Just amazing, amazing stuff. Lastly, we had something going on in the Senate. Some senators want out of Afghanistan. I want out of Afghanistan.
I was in Afghanistan twice. I was over there when the whole war started. And we were there, and we, you know, routed out the Al-Qaeda, which is great, and Karzai's there. But at this point in time, I don't know what more we can do. And then, you know, they tell us to apologize. They tell us to leave. A lot of different signals are coming out of there. But 26 senators, including two Republicans, went with the Democrats to sign a letter and said, let's go. It's time to leave. So I think there'll be a lot of pressure on the White House to do something. And a couple more bad incidences, the public will be tired of it, I hope. But then again, Senator McCain, on the other hand, is rattling the war saber, you know, take over Syria and go into Iran and things like that. But the Senate has taken most of the majority, have at least taken a different position.
Yeah, and Iran is the last place we need to be ending up in war. And, you know, as we had talked earlier about the Cato Institute, who the Koch brothers are trying to take over and turn into another one of their hit groups, they're firmly against. I mean, this is a very libertarian group, firmly against going into Iran. And they claim that, you know, all of the hype and all of the information about their nuclear program is really just that, overly hyped.
And the president took a very good statesman-like position. He knew this was getting into the Republican primary, and he made a statement on Super Tuesday. You know, are you going to explain war? Explain it, and tell what you're really, really saying, because it sends mixed signals that goes way beyond politics. This is really a serious issue. And the president supports Israel, but he didn't come out of the meeting saying, "I got my finger on the trigger."
Right. You know, you had mentioned that you lived in Iran last time I talked to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that I always thought an opportunity I think we missed is that after 9/11, you know, they were holding candlelight vigils in Tehran. I thought there was an opportunity to reach out to the younger generation there to kind of sway them and say, hey, we're not Islamophobics. We just want, you know, democracy and all this stuff. I thought there was an opportunity during the Bush years, and I think we missed that. And now with someone like Santorum, who's gone on the whole Islamo-fascist thing that he ran on in 2006, I'm afraid that window is closed. So I'd be curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, there's two things. You're right on the one opportunity. The second, there's a book by Dr. Tridop Parsi, P-A-R-S-I, called Treacherous Alliances, The Secret Deals. I'm in that book because a secret agreement was brought to me by the ambassador from Switzerland, and we presented it to the Bush administration, and it was rejected and would have given us Americans on the ground in Iran to do inspections. That was the second opportunity, and the candlelight vigil was the first. So we've had a couple of chances, and the Bush administration, Cheney, would have no part of it, I was told. And they even denied they even received it from me, but then it was proven that, Condoleezza Rice did have knowledge of it. So.
Wow. Given that scenario and given where we've gone recently, I'm just curious what your thoughts are. Is it possible to have another opening? Because I think you have to engage the reformers in that country to get them to take over and not get into a scenario where it looks like we're invading or occupying or anything, because that will be met with more resistance than we saw in Iraq or Afghanistan.
That's like, you know, say that you really can't stand the president here. Just say you really can't stand him, but you and a foreign power says, hey, I'll come in and I'll do something about it. You'd be like, wait a minute. You know,
absolutely.
Wait a minute. And that's the same in reverse. You know, a foreign power going in will turn the pro-American Iranians against us. The president's doing the balance. He's doing sanctions. You know, he's doing the balanced approach, opening up always an avenue if some diplomacy can work. And
no, I mean,
that's what we can try that.
Yeah, I mean, Reagan had the hot phone to the Russians. We should have nothing less.
That's right.
Bob Ney, it's always great talking with you.
I
love the insight. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this Safety Bill of Rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or are likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, best place to go to get the podcast or get the smartphone with the Stitcher app. And you look at the Texas-based super PAC called Campaign for Primary Accountability. Who were the big money in Ohio, in Cuyahoga, said robocalls and mailers throughout Cuyahoga County, getting voters to turn against Kucinich. And during the break, I got an email from Andy who asked the question, and Marcy Kaptur supports the Keystone XL. Do you think this is why she got elected? She said one of the reasons, getting the job done for big oil. And look, I like Marcy Kaptur. There's a whole bunch of things with this, but she was one of the first people out there saying, if the banks are going to take your house, make them show you the note. She was emphatic about that. But the reason Dennis lost, truth of the matter is, every person that I talked to back in Cleveland said the same thing. Look at our roads. Look at our infrastructure. Look at the fact that he was out doing things on the national scene. He wasn't representing our interests the way we wanted. And that really is the biggest knock against Dennis. He's a big thinker. He's a good guy. He's somebody you need to push the agenda. But at the end of the day, as I said on Wednesday when I came back, bouncing up and down on the roads that have had potholes in it for the last 20 years since I lived there, that hasn't changed. The roads, the infrastructure, everything is crumbling. And a lot of it is not, I mean, it's not his fault. I mean, it's 30 years of disinvestment. It's, you know, it's the Voinovich years where the city of Cleveland just gave away massive amounts of tax abatements and free energy and free all kind of stuff. You name it, we were giving it away because we wanted to be business friendly. You know, we wanted to steal those businesses from New York or from Massachusetts or other places. Say, come to Cleveland, you could get a real good deal. And we've got a good educated workforce because the schools were semi-decent at the time, having just ended that insanity of busing. And again, you go back and you think of all of the attacks on education, busing being one of them, where you're going, oh, wow, we're going to bus poor kids from the west side of Cleveland all the way over to the east side and then back. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. But it is what we do in this country. And again, I go back to Dennis. He lost because, you know, people are looking at their roads and saying we got trouble. Anyway, I've got Ellen Ratner on the line, Talk Radio News Service. She is in the peninsula of Antarctica on a satellite phone. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much. If we hang off, and sometimes it hangs me up, immediately I'll call back. But basically, I'm with a group called 2041, and they're interested in preserving the treaty that ends in 2041. Rick, one of the facts I never knew is that 70% of the world's fresh is held in those glaciers in Antarctica. If we start messing around with drilling and that kind of thing, who knows whether that fresh water is going to be preserved. And there's also some people here who are trying to live at a research station on sustainable development, windmills, et cetera. I know a lot of people get very freaked out and say, well, you know, oil produces jobs. Yes, it does. But so can green jobs.
Yeah, and water, I need to live.
Are you there?
Yep, water is something I need to live. I need water to survive. You know, we can't screw it up with oil development.
That's right, exactly. I wish you could follow along what we're doing. He's been sort of a one-man band trying to do this. He is actually the only man to have gone to the North, walked the North Pole and the South Pole.
Wow. So what are you hoping to accomplish here? I mean, what kind of media attention are we getting? What's the goal here?
The goal is to get media attention for and encouraging that treaty to be back in force or to go past 2041 and to let people know that, you know, once we, if that treaty goes away, also various countries can put their claim and stake in Antarctica, be it Russia or Japan or China or Argentina. And if the treaty's in effect, Antarctica, which is about the size of Australia, Antarctica will still be owned by no one, and it will be owned by everyone, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah, I agree. But I had read somewhere that Russia had staked a flag there.
Not everybody puts their flags there, but whether they're allowed to continue it as their territory,
right,
under this treaty, nobody is allowed to actually claim it. You can put your flag there. In fact, I was at a Russian research station this afternoon. And they're very active here, as is America, as is the United States has been here since almost the end of World War II, if not before. So a lot of countries are here, but it doesn't mean that they own Antarctica.
Yeah, with as much water as there, I mean, it's a global importance. So as I've been reading reports, is it melting? I mean, some of the people you're talking to, are they saying that it's melting?
Yes. In fact, when we camped out one night, Rick, not something that I would ever want to do again. We didn't camp out in a tent. We had a sleeping bag, and it began to rain. So when we were camping out, we would hear these glaciers, what's that called, calving, which essentially means a piece of ice. It gets warmed up, and it drops in the sea. Now, some of that is totally natural. But it's the rate that it is calving that is a concern to people. And tomorrow, we're going to see one of those huge pieces of ice that, you know, that has dropped off, and everybody's quite shocked about it. And in fact, you know how we talk about holes in the ozone and whether it's open or closing? The leader of this, Robert Swan, when he climbed to the North Pole or went to the North Pole, his expedition the first time, what he did not realize is that there was this hole in the ozone, and his eye changed color.
Wow. That's amazing. I got to tell you, Ellen, you are my absolute hero. The more I hang around with you, the more I know you. You are just an amazing woman to me.
Well, thank you. And listen, anybody wants to put their two cents in, you can look at 2041.com, see what we're up to. I'll put up some of my pictures when I get home, but because the internet here is so expensive, there is an internet on the ship. For like $20 a picture, I decided to forego that.
Yeah, we'll wait till you get back, and I can't wait to hear your stories. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service from Antarctica. And look, you know, you can go to the website 2041.com. We'll make sure we get a link at the ricksmithshow.com. And as, you know, as she's pointed, there's a clicker up there. There's just 29 years left, 10,525 days left in this treaty, where nobody, like she said, nobody owns it. And there's an opportunity. I'm hoping to push this on because 70% of the world's water, 70%. And then you got people saying, well, we should drill, baby, drill, because there might be oil there. Just amazing. Maybe we could privatize Antarctica. Maybe, like we're doing, like the receiver in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania wants to do, maybe we could sell off Antarctica. I bet you we'd get a nice quick buck for it, don't you think? Sell off 70% of the world's water. Just think what the bottlers could do then. And it would be more than the tap water that they sell us. Because understand, you know, Dasani and Aquafina, basically filtered tap water. Well, not basically. It is. It's filtered tap water. We pay like a buck and a half for a liter of that. Imagine the marketing campaign around water from Antarctica. Fresh from the North Pole. And it'd be like $6 a bottle. Even though 70% of the world's water is right there. I mean, I can envision the possibilities. So maybe, hold on, maybe I'm not in favor of the treaty. Maybe we need to tear that treaty down, let corporate America take over. They'll know how to deal with it. They'll take care of it. They'll act in the best interest of all of us. And if you believe that, I've got the deed to Antarctica. The website 2041.com. Of course, we'll get a link over at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm glad she had the opportunity to call because, you know, sometimes dealing with those satellite phones, spotty, sounded all right there. I was looking at what the temperature was she was sleeping out in, 37 degrees right now in Antarctica. I can't imagine what it drops down to at night. The woman's just amazing to me. She's over 60. She was, you know, down in during Hurricane Katrina. She was down there, you know, helping people there, helping rebuild. Ended up losing an eye because of an infection she got while she was there. You know, she goes to the Sudan. You know, she does that, goats for the old goat thing she does to get goats to the people of Sudan. Because something I learned from her, evidently you can drink goat's milk right from the tap. Can't do that with cow's milk, although there's some here locally who say, oh, nothing like raw cow's milk. And then you find out they get sick and some of them die. And I go, okay, that's how you thin the herd. Nice job. Goodbye. But evidently goat's milk, you can, I guess, tap dive. So I wonder what Neil Horsley would do then. The guy who believes that, you know, in Georgia, every farm boy's first girlfriend was a cow. I wonder what he would do with, well, never mind. Anyway, that just kind of struck me as funny. Anyway, there are a dozen communities in Vermont who are voting to end corporate personhood. You know, going back to the thing with Dennis Kucinich and the Texas money coming in. And I think you got to get money out of politics altogether, and make it, you know, local people. Make it about people again. You know, and I've read a lot of stories, especially during the 40s and 50s, where people had like $50, but they had people, and it was inclusive. It was people coming together, and they picked their leader. And maybe I'm just pining for days that will never come back, because I think unless there's a massive movement, corporate personhood is probably here for a while. The billionaire class is not going to give it up. They like having the power. They like having the control. They like being able to jerk us around. And, of course, you know, benefit for themselves, which they do quite well. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, the best place to go and get it. If you have a smartphone, the Stitcher app. Stitcher. You can take the program on the go with you. And, of course, you can always email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array.